Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the island-chained paradise in the sunny slave South Pacific, with such wonderful Fukushima radiation that helps all the sunbathers soak up the rays. And my very special guest today is Marty Leeds. Marty, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on, man.
And just like Back to the Future, his computer also requires 1.21 gigawatts. Now, would you be able to give us a bit of a preface and an explanation about who you are, what it is you do, and what we're going to be talking about today?
Sure. I am basically what I'm known for is uncovering a cipher, or what's known as a cryptogram, basically a number letter to correlation cipher for the English alphabet. And this is based on a lot of like secret society symbols, religious symbols, things like that. And so that's kind of what I'm known for. MartyLeeds33.com is my website. You can get my lecture series. I have a free lecture series, like 40 or so lectures up right now. I just posted one today, in fact, on the Hebrew alphabet. So that's all available on YouTube, MartyLeeds33. And then I have a couple books for sale. I just released two books on the end of January. One's called The Peacock's Tales, the Alchemical Writings of Claudia Pavonis. And then Pie in the English Alphabet, Volume 1, which is a second edition I did. And then I have this Volume 2, the second edition, should actually be out, I'm hoping, next week. So those three books available on my site. You can get them on Amazon.com. And yeah, that's kind of me in a nutshell anyway.
And you contacted me. You wanted to come on the show, and you said you had a few things prepared. What are they?
Well, it depends on what you want to go into. I mean, I know we have quite a lot of time.
You know me, bro. I go into anything. Unless it involves me actually, except unless it involves me personally committing scumbaggery, unless I'm not keen on it. But if it involves scumbaggery or anything else, even like mystical, it might even be unproven. It could be theoretical. I don't care. Everybody's got a story, and every bit of information counts, even if it's not true.
Sure. So yeah, there's a bunch of stuff we can go into. I figured we could go into the cipher and explain that and show. I've got some things I can show to show some of the symbolism so you can actually see it. And I know if people are listening to this, you can go in online and check this stuff out yourself. You know, we got Google nowadays. It takes like 2 seconds. So, but I was thinking that we could go into the history of it. We could go into, you know, like I said, explain the cipher and then maybe just break down a few things, possibly the name of Jesus Christ. We could look at Holy Bible. We could look at Skull and Bones. We could look at, there's just a bunch of different things that we could look at and really break down and show why this thing works, why it's important, and then maybe even go into I don't know how else to say this, but the divine nature of mathematics. Yeah. And kind of understanding that. So I don't know where you want to start. We could explain the cipher maybe, or sure. Go into the history of it.
Obviously, it's better to explain the cipher, then go into the history of it, because that actually gives us a good grounding for an actual discussion.
Sure. Okay. So basically what I did is I've been studying sacred geometry, sacred number, occult sciences, philosophy, psychology, these sorts of things for quite a while, probably, you know, intensely for about 5 years or something like that, I'd say. And on and off on my whole life too. But so basically what I did is this science is called gematria. It's also known as Kabbalah. It's called, I think it's in Greek, it's called isospathy or something like that. I can never pronounce that. But it's basically this idea of putting numbers to letters. And this was a very ancient, like, occult science. Many cultures have done this. We know we still have ciphers for the Greek and Hebrew languages. I actually print them in the back of my books. And so we know that texts like the Holy Bible, when they were originally written, were written with this mathematical foundation. And this is what's important. So basically what I'm saying is that when the new King James Version, this authorized version, which we'll get into the history of this, was written, it was written mathematically. And this is how you're supposed to read these texts. And so that's, you know, just a little preface there. So what I did is I took the 26 letters of the English alphabet and I split them in half. So we have 26 letters and I split them in A through M and N through Z. And then what I did is I just walked up the motif that we see in the Holy Bible with the 6 days of God doing work and then resting on the seventh. And this is, of course, a mythological motif. It's nothing literal about this. So I sent A through M and N through Z. And so I went A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and then I stopped. So I went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and I stopped at that G. And then what I did is I ended up just walking back down to H-I-J-K-L-M being 6-5-4-3-2-1. Now, why this is important in stopping at that G is, of course, let me just grab this here. We all know this symbol very well.
Oh, yeah.
That's the Freemasonic square and compasses, and that's a big old fat G right there.
I thought that was a rap group called G Unit.
I'm not sure. Are they Freemasons?
I don't know. I think they're just slaves like the rest of us.
They have no idea they're being manipulated by the Freemasonic Council, right? So basically, A through M, I walked up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, arrested on that G, H, I, J, K, L, M, B, and 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now, by splitting the alphabet 13 letters and 13 letters, what I did is I just took those letters and I threw them onto the other side of the alphabet. Just symmetry, balance is basically what you're doing. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, we're just going to throw that to it. So N-O-P-Q-R-S-T. UVWXYZ is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, resting on that T, and then UVWXYZ is 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And really what this does is it shows that the cipher was built on like these strong philosophical constants, things like symmetry, balance, things like that. And if you look at your entire body, I mean, just starting from your head, of course. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, actually finish your point.
So by splitting the alphabet, the reason that I split the alphabet in the first place is because if you just look, your body's completely mirrored. Your whole entire body's mirrored. Your brain pan's mirrored, your eyes are mirrored, nostrils, your teeth are even mirrored, ears, shoulders, hands, etc. So I basically took testicles. Yes, that's right. So I took this idea and I just threw it onto the English alphabet. And then I used the motif, as I said, in the Holy Bible, walking up to this G. Now, why this is important is, I'll show this here. Is what you can do is with this is pull out the non-prime numbers in your alphabet. So once again, we went A through M. I'm just going to focus on that. And this is the non-prime prime number is a number divisible by 1 in itself. So a non-primes would be 1, 4, 6, and 6, 4, 1 in our alphabet. So 1 plus 4 plus 6 plus 6 plus 4 plus 1 equals 22. And this leads us right to the central 7, that G, where we stopped. And 22 divided by 7 is an approximation of pi begotten by whole numbers. It's 22 divided by 7 is 3.142. And so you can see, hopefully I can show this here, but I've got this on my site. You can double check all this stuff for free if you'd like. But you can see here, I'll show this. That is the Jewish menorah, and that is highlighting the non-prime numbers in our cipher.
For those, the uninitiated and those listening on the radio, the Jewish menorah, did you say? It's kind of like a quintessential thing on Hanukkah, the many, many sticks of the candles and the candelabra, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a 7-branch menorah. That's, I think there's a 7 and 9-branch menorah, I want to say, but this is using the 7-branch menorah. So what this is showing is actually you can use this symbol to deconstruct our English alphabet and create pi. And pi is an infinite transcendental number. It's and this is an approximation of pi, of course. But pi is a ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter. And it's a very key number. It's a constant in mathematics. And so this number is, it's a very important number. And so we find this number in our A through M in our alphabet. Well, because we had the symmetry, we had that balance, we just had a mirror, if you will. We just took those numbers and threw it on the other side. We have the exact same thing on the other side. So we have A through M, N through Z, both encoding pi and resting on the one side on that G. And then, of course, on the other side is the T. And if you know anything about Freemasonic symbols, what that T is actually referencing is another mathematical thing called the Tau cross. And the Tau cross is actually a symbol for man. I don't really want to get into that here, but if you can check that out, just Google that. Just do Google Tau cross, and you're going to see some Freemason symbols there. So that said, so what this does is establish the cipher for the English alphabet. Now, that's just one way of deconstructing this, right? Now, there's a couple different ways. Number one, we just put pi on one side of the alphabet and pi on the other, right? So this is 2 pi. And this pi is begotten by 7. It's 22 divided by 7 to give you this 3.142. Well, this right here, and what this symbol is, and you can look this up once again, this is called the Tetragrammaton. And this is the holy name of God. And if you can see that very clearly, that says pi 7. Pi 7. And so what this is saying
for those listening in the radio audience as well, that's a diamond shape with kind of like floral patterns around the outside of the diamond, and within the diamond you actually have the number 7 and the symbol for pi twice side by side.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. So, and there's a bunch of different symbolic representations of this, and all of them are very similar. So it's basically, and this thing is called the Tetragrammaton. And what the Tetragrammaton is, the holy name of God. And this was known as Yahweh or Jehovah, right? And the Tetragrammaton, well, gramma means message. And this is where we get the word grammar, of course. And so it stands to reason that this holy name of God, this Jehovah, this Yahweh, that a lot of people have a lot of misconceptions about, by the way, and we'll get into this, but that this thing is encoded within our alphabet. And then understanding that these sacred texts were written mathematically, this allows you to understand what exactly they were talking about when they talk about God. They're not talking about a bearded man in the sky who sits in a cloud, who plays a mean harp that's got a long beard and a big penis. You know, that's not what they're talking about. They're talking about something. Really, what they're talking about is a nature force, and that this nature force can be understood through geometry and number. So this is why some of this is important. So I just wanted to show that. I also wanted to show this. This is the Ouija board.
Everybody knows what a Ouija board is.
Everybody knows what a Ouija board is. If you can see there, that's splitting the alphabet A through M. N through Z, and where does it arch up to? The G and T. That's exactly where we stopped in our alphabet.
Oh, wow.
You can look up the Ouija board. This is what's known as the emblem of Israel. Oh, see if I can get this in the screenshot there.
It's the seven-stick candelabra with olive branches on the left and the right. It's like a shield as well with writing down the bottom. What is that writing? Is that Hebrew?
Yeah, it's Hebrew. That means it's Israel. I think this is Lamed Shin. I'm going to get that wrong. So, but it's Hebrew.
It's probably pronounced with some way, you know.
yeah, exactly. So why this is important is, of course, we just saw that we separated the non-prime numbers and that led to the G and T, right? Well, this is exactly what this is symbolizing here. And then if you notice on this side here, there is, I'm sorry if I'm getting this wrong. There's 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or A, B, C, D, E, F, and then G. And you have the exact same thing going down. H, I, J, K, L, M.
Well, you're talking about the numbers of the two olive branches on either sides actually mimic the six leaves going up and one leaf at the top and then all the way back down again. So you've got 13 leaves on both sides and the top leaf symbolizing the T and the G.
Yes, exactly. So what's being said here is this is the cipher, the gematria for our English alphabet. And not only this, is we can actually take some of this into Hebrew as well, which we don't have time to really go into right now. But basically, that's what I wanted to show that there's multiple ways and multiple symbols to get this very particular number to letter correlation. So
this conversation is making me feel a bit like I have in a G&T.
So. You're throwing me off, man. So, okay, that's what you do. So all of those different symbols, the Ouija board, the Tetragrammaton, the Freemasonic square and compasses, of course, the emblem of Israel, etc. There's a couple other different ways that you can decode the cipher as well that I've got videos on. You can use dice to decode this, and you can also use the chromatic music scale to find this very particular number to letter correlation. So that's the cipher, and we can go into the applicability of this cipher and why it's so important. But I just wanted to lay that out, and maybe we can try to go into some of the history of it, if you'd like.
Go for your life.
So Freemasonry was established in a very particular time, and this is well-known by, like Albert Mackey talks about this, Albert Pike talks about this. This is just well-known in history that Freemasonry was established, and of course it's a reimagination of a lot of these other secret societies. Well, this was established in like the 16th and 17th century we're talking about. Basically what we're going to do is carve out a chunk of time, like 1450 around there to like, 1650, 1500s to 1650, somewhere around there. Now, a whole bunch of really, really interesting things was going on at this point in our history. At this point in our history, we know for a fact that the 26 letters of our English alphabet that we use right now was established at this time. Now, how do we know this? The first dictionaries were being printed. First dictionary was printed in 1604, and this was a dictionary dedicated to the 26 letters of our English alphabet. We had a renaissance of thought going on at the time. We basically had some of the greatest artisans, scientists that were living at this time, Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, Giordano Bruno, Francis Bacon, Rene Descartes, all of these guys, artists like Michelangelo, Raphael, Leonardo, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, all of them. So a bunch of really great artists, Renaissance thinkers. We also had a rise in alchemy at this time. So once again, we're talking 1500 to 1650. John D. Edward Kelly, just some of the most famous alchemists of all time. They were living at this time. Johann Daniel Milius, Michael Mayer, Anastasius Kircher, Henrik Nolius. Just some really, really famous alchemists. If you're not familiar with these guys, all you have to do is, once again, just do a Google search. So we had the first dictionaries being printed, a renaissance of thought, rise of alchemy. You also had the original Greek Holy Bible was being translated into modern English at this time. So this was 1611 this happened. So we had King James and his 72 translators translating the original Greek into the modern English the modern English Bible. So that was going on. You also had what was known as this great vowel shift, where there was literally a change in our alphabet at this time. There was a little change in how we spoke vowels at this time. And so you had all of that. You had the establishment of Freemasonry. And then you also had a man named William Shakespeare living at this time. So all of this, we know for a fact that our English language was being established at this time. We had all of this stuff going on. And William Shakespeare was living at this time. And now we know that, you know, William Shakespeare was basically, there's a lot of evidence to say that he wasn't a singular man, that this was basically a guild of writers, of alchemists, of artisans, of astrologers, of, you know, et cetera, poets that were getting together and creating these, you know, the sonnets and plays and things like that.
Sir Ken Robinson talked about education and this kind of thing, and he wondered who was William Shakespeare's English teacher. You know, what was it like for William Shakespeare being a seven-year-old boy? You know, Shakespeare, go to bed and stop talking like that. You're confusing people.
That's funny, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, he widely regarded as one of the greatest literary figures of all time, right? I mean, there's really no question about that. I mean, he wrote some of the greatest literary works of all time. And, of course, this was probably, like I said, a guild of writers that were doing this. Now, William Shakespeare gave us over 20,000 words of our modern English language. And so I get criticized, yes, and this is well known. Once again, this is just modern academia will say this. So, you know, I get criticized a lot for being, you know, creative or that sort of thing, imaginative with language, and yet poetic, if you will. And yet a poet gave us a whole chunk of our language. So that really needs to, you know, be cognizant of that when we go and try to deconstruct language. We can't really deconstruct it in this very mechanistic, very, you know, rigid kind of way, because
that's kind of crazy. It's imposing rules where rules are changeable and rewritable, right? That's why I call them academia nuts.
Yeah, exactly. That, I mean, that's really what it is. I mean, academia wants to look at everything in this sort of boxed fashion, this very just, it's only critical thinking. It's only, if you will, the left hemisphere of your brain thinking. And this is just stifling us in so many different ways, especially when it comes to linguistics and philology and our history as well. So. So that's it. So let me just go over this one more time. What was going on at this time period? Let's say 1500 to 1650. You had the first dictionaries being printed. You had the rise of a resurgence of alchemy. You had a renaissance of thought. You had the King James Bible being translated from the original Greek. You had William Shakespeare. You know, you had a great vowel shift happening. And you had, to top it all off, you had the establishment of Freemasonry at this time. And like I just said, I got this cipher from a Freemason symbol directly. And this is what this is encoding. And so there's a really, really strong historical case, or this is a really good historical case or context for what was going on at this time and why this cipher, if you will, is correct. And so this is, you know, a lot of evidence to say that, yeah, this is what was going on. It's very well known. And of course, we have other languages that have ciphers. And a lot of the language, our language was based on, you could say, Middle English, Latin, Greek, Hebrew, without question. And, you know, here we are.
So now you're specifically talking about the Renaissance. Is this 17th or 18th century?
Well, there, I mean,
1600s and 1700s, or
yeah, basically you're looking at from, you know, carving out, like I said, like probably like 1500 to 1650. You kind of had this Renaissance of thought. I mean, Da Vinci was before that, and of course he had the Italian Renaissance as well. But I mean, this is really kind of tumbling. There was a lot going on at this time of our history.
Somebody told me once that during that period of time there was an enormous spread of mushroom spores, magic mushroom spores, and because people weren't washing their food, washing the dirt out of their food and what have you, they were actually consuming a lot of these hallucinogenic mushrooms, and this person alleged that that was part of the reason why the Renaissance happened, is because, and why all these new thoughts and ideas and things started to come out, is because people were starting to trip.
That very well could. I mean, it's pretty, you know, it's a lot of conjecture. It's a lot of just, you know, we don't really know, but I mean, very well. I mean, when you look at, you know, the 60s and 70s, so whatever you think about that era or whatever you think about it, you know, there was a lot of great music and things that came out, a lot of great art, a lot of great philosophy, a lot of great new ideas, I would say. A lot of bad ideas, too, don't get me wrong. But, you know,
The 70s is, I believe, the only decade throughout the entirety of history where behavior during that decade is excused because it was that decade, you know? Hey, it was the 70s.
That's a good point, man. I never thought about that. Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, because if that was going on now, well, that is kind of going on now. Look, we're getting beat by cops. And of course, that was happening then, too. You know, I think it's just at a different scale now, right? They just have more guns and more mace and more tasers and, you know, a bigger government. And so, anyway.
We don't have quite as many excuses as those in the 70s once had, you know.
Yeah. So to get back to, you know, what we're talking about here. So, yeah, that's the history of it. So kind of explaining the cipher. All the different ways you can build the cipher, and then the history of it. And the reason that I want to kind of lay this out is basically because, because of modern science, because of the way that we look at critical thinking. A lot of times critical thinking, or quote-unquote critical thinkers, will look at something and, you know, the fundamental tenets of modern science is to attack the first premise. So, okay, saying the first premise is wrong. Your cipher is incorrect. There's no way it could be correct, right? So we're going to attack the first premise, and therefore everything after, everything you talk about, every book that you write, every, you know, video or lecture that you put forward is incorrect. Well, what I'm trying to lay out is a very rational, very logical, very reasonable case as to why this cipher is correct, not only the multiple ways that you can build it, but also with the historical context as well. And so that's why I kind of wanted to say that. Another really interesting thing about this is yet again follows the fundamental tenets of science. And what I'm saying is it's empirical, it's repeatable, it's verifiable. And not only that, it follows what's known as like the principle of parsimony or Occam's razor. You probably know about this, right?
I know. It's used as one of the best excuses for not listening to anybody about any new information that the person fundamentally doesn't agree with their beliefs. Occam's razor is really handy.
What? Say that again? I'm sorry.
Occam's razor, in many of the cases when I've been talking to people who have been using it, use Occam's razor as an excuse to not believe anything or even look into any kind of information that they fundamentally don't agree with their belief structures. It's kind of being misused in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like 9/11. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah, I get what you're saying. Absolutely. So Occam's razor, though, in like scientific mechanics, though, is the idea that, okay, we have an explanation. We have two explanations for a phenomenon. You're going to most often choose the simpler one. Well, in this cipher, we use the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 four different times. Well, that's very, very simple. And when you look at it in that sort of mindset, then you really say that, okay, well, what's more correct? Is it using the numbers 1 through 26? Or is it, or are we going to go through something simple to 1 through 7? Well, that's, you know, or use a septenary system, which means a system of seven, basically. And so that, once again, that follows, once again, the fundamental tenets of modern science. So
and how many deadly,
I just kinda wanna lay that out.
How many deadly sins are there?
There's seven. Well, you know, the number seven isn't lost here because the number seven is just extremely important throughout all mythology, throughout all history.
It's funny that you mention that because I remember there was a board game done by Parker Brothers called The Game of Life. I'm not sure if you've ever heard this, but when I was playing it, I think I was 8 years old, I think. And sometimes you pick up a card and it gives you a lucky number. And mine was seven. And I've actually been kind of thinking that it was just a game, but to me, seven really resonated with me, and it's actually been kind of my lucky number ever since. It's since expanded for that from seven being my lucky number to include the number 33, and I live at number 33. My desk was bought that holds all these computers and everything with which I expose scumbaggery. My desk, when we were at the auction, was lot 33. And there's just so many others. It just pops up all over the place. It's like it's surrounding me.
Yeah. Well, that just proves you're a Satanist.
Yeah, totally.
And me too, apparently, because I'm Marty Lee 33. So yeah, it's really interesting how absolutely. I mean, people tell me this all the time when they come and watch the videos, or you know, send me an email or something like that, is that numbers have been surrounded by with them their entire lives. That numbers will keep popping up again and again and again, whether it's 333, 1111, 33, 7. You know, I had this one guy said that his entire life was surrounded by the number 23, and it was only that when he saw my video, it was like it started to actually make sense to him why. And maybe we can get into what numbers are. Let's just go to there. Let's go to geometry and numbers. You know, according to some of the greatest... Sorry, go ahead.
Can I say one thing? I learned Japanese once, and what struck me as very interesting is that the numbers in Japanese were exactly the same as the numbers in English. Like, numbers everywhere kind of appeared exactly the same. But I'm not sure if there were actually different symbols in Japanese for numbers, or whether or not they were using the exact same kind of symbols that we use in the English language. I'm not sure if you know anything about this.
No, I don't.
I presume every language must have different symbols for like 1, 2, 3, and 4 and all the different numbers, right?
Yeah, I think. I mean, there is a lot of, especially when you look at letters as well, too, that, I mean, there's a lot of cross-cultural, that they share a lot of the same elements, a lot of the same themes in letters, you know, like, and especially when there's numbers put to these alphabets. But when you look at like, you know, the alphabet is Hebrew. The alphabet is Latin. The alphabet is English. You know, there's Aleph Ba is Syriac, I want to say. You know, you have Alpha Beta is Greek, etc. You know, you have the same themes coming up again and again. And so I think that whether there's been an evolution or it's crafted from these other languages and things like that, I think numbers fall in the same category, if you know what I'm saying.
Perhaps there was a dissolution. You know, when you go across America, you have all these different accents and different usage of words, sayings, and things of that nature. But you understand that they all came from the same root of the colonization, and then they spread out and it became so different over time. What if way long ago all language, all culture, laws, mathematics, and everything existed within one culture, and then from there they spread out all over the earth and started to change a little bit with their own little dialects over long periods of time?
Yeah, very well could. I mean, I guess when you look at the Tower of Babel, right, the confusion of tongues, you have this idea that there was one language spoken. Of course, this is very cryptic. I think it's very metaphorical. But at the same time, we could have a concentration of group of people, and then, yeah, you know, a flood, a pole shift, a tsunami, or, you know, something happened that spread people out, etc. And then, of course, the languages changed. We have a tendency to look at language as in a very Darwinian evolution kind of sense, that languages just evolve and they are not created or whatever. And we really don't
know. Tell that to Gene Roddenberry, who created the language of Klingon.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Or John Dee created the Enochian language. Of course, he said that he received it, or, you know, channeled it, or whatever he said. But yeah, I mean, there's ample evidence that languages could be created, and probably were created with a deep understanding of nature, I would say, a deep understanding of the human being and his relationship to the divine, the cosmos, the universe, etc. So, and when you look at the evolution of language, you know, saying it, well, languages do evolve. Of course, dialects evolve. You know, inflections evolve, new words are created, sure, absolutely. But do languages evolve? We don't really know. In fact, the evidence points to say they don't evolve. How long has Hebrew been around? The 22 letters in the 5 finals of Hebrew have been around for at least 2,500 years, if not way before that. 24 letters of Greek, same thing.
May I make a point of agreement with you here that languages don't evolve? I think they devolve, though. They certainly do. I mean, for example, about 100 years ago, if a man who knew you saw you in the street, he would remove his top hat, say, hello, sir, how goes the morrow? How was your family? And all of that kind of stuff. And that's been shortened over time to sup.
I mean, honestly, you know, I don't know if this is in a cosmic sense. I think this is done deliberately. But yes, we are being devolved right now. We are being dumbed down, and we are, you know, that sort of thing. So, yeah, I mean, of course, that's, you know, so languages, of course, are going to follow that, you know. I mean, this is thanks to our wonderful school system, of course, right, and wonderful governments and politicians and whatnot. So.
And the academia nuts who defend it against all enemies, foreign and domestic, regardless of whether or not they can think or think critically, because university doesn't teach critical thinking anymore. It only teaches you to be critical of people who can still think despite going to university.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, the other thing we're talking about too, about critical thinking and imaginative thinking, I think it's a holistic approach, of course, right? That to truly understand the world, you have to have both, if you will, hemispheres of your brain, both modes of thinking working. So not only do we have the degradation of our school systems and the manipulation and the conditioning of our school systems with the loss of critical thinking, they don't even teach imaginative thinking at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many school systems have lost music programs, have lost dance, have lost all of these things? And that's exactly what that, you know, that lightens up this side of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, it's a tragedy.
It's the brain equivalent of a, let's say, a world champion runner, gold medalist, Olympic athlete runner, saying, you know what, maybe I can just do without my left leg or my right leg or something like that, you know, and just be like, and I'll probably still run as far. No! Nobody would do that because it's insane. Yet we psychologically do that to other people and to ourselves.
Yeah, that is a great analogy, by the way. I mean, that's a perfect analogy because it's saying, hey, go run a marathon, but only use one leg, you know? So, yeah, great. So, we were kind of talking about the evolution of language, and I just kind of wanted to address that a little bit, too, that we really don't know if languages evolve, you know? And we do have an old English, a middle English, and then a modern English, right? But there's nothing saying that modern English wasn't built off, you know, themes and elements, an understanding of Latin as and Middle English and Hebrew and Greek and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And I think that that's actually, I think there's more evidence to point to that. And then, of course, then once again, when we look at the history of it, we're talking about, you know, all of this amazing things going on at this time. So,
And English is a conglomeration of a number of different European languages. I mean, when I'm learning them, I see so many similar words in Spanish and English, French and English, German and English. There's even some Russian words in English and what have you here or there. But it occurs to me that Latin seems to be a big part of it. Now, kind of a lot older language than, or at least one of the more older written languages, because I think the Romans came up with literacy and what have you a little bit before, say, the Germanic and the Goths and the other ancient cultures, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, Latin's been around for a long time. I mean, that was the language that was spoken in the church. That was the language that the Bibles were written in. That was the language of the Holy Roman Empire. And of course, we know all the wonderful things that the Holy Roman Empire has done. So, I mean, yeah, and especially when you look at Latin too. Latin is, I mean, it's basically the exact same letters. Not even basically, it's the exact same letters of the English alphabet, save for three letters, B, W, and J. And yet, look at how Latin is spoken. I can't speak Latin. I can't understand it. I mean, the syntax is different. The orthography is different, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And so here we have the exact same letters, essentially, save for three letters, and yet a completely different language.
Maybe because the people who were speaking Latin didn't want anybody thinking they could have a J while they were driving their VW.
Did you just come up with that?
Yeah, I'm sorry. That was just terrible.
No, it's funny. I was like, anyway, yeah, that's great. So we kind of went over the history, went over the cipher, and kind of went over the evolution of language. So I don't know where you want to take this, or if there's anything that you
talked about Jesus and his name in the cipher.
I was thinking about before going into that, maybe talking about the secret societies just a little bit before going into that.
Sure.
To try to understand really what these secret societies, the knowledge that they're holding. When this was begotten by a Freemason symbol. Then we'll go into Jesus here. So it's in my opinion that the original inception of Freemasonry, just like the original inception of Christianity, was a noble, just, you know, holy institution. Right. And that this institution was trying to pass on the deep occult knowledge of great antiquity, the arcane science of old, basically. One of these sciences being gematria. And that they knew that throughout time, people were going to try to usurp and, you know, dumb people down, just like we're seeing it right now, usurp this knowledge and keep it for themselves. Right. And that originally, Freemasonry was trying to pass on this knowledge. And I think that because there's so much aura and mystery and secrecy around Freemasonry, I think the reason for that is that eventually people would go and be like, what are these people doing? What's going on behind those doors? And start questioning. And then when they start questioning, they'll go and look at these symbols, look at these rituals, you know, look at all of this stuff, and then allow this information to come out again. And that's an interesting claim, because most people have, they have these preconceptions about what Freemasonry is. It's an evil organization. It's the Illuminati. It's New World Order, this sort of thing. And are there factions that have infiltrated these groups? Yeah, I of course. Right. I mean, there can be no question about it. But the thing that we have to ask ourselves is why? Why do these extremely powerful people go and go towards this secret society? Why would they do that? Is it just because it's an old boys club? Or is it because they know that there is actual knowledge, deep occult knowledge about the science of, I'll just say this, the science of what it is to be a human being? That's what I think that these people are holding.
Frederick X has been a member of 9 different occult orders, and he has come out and said that there are a number of different kinds of Masons within Freemasonry. There are what are known as porch Masons, who go to the lodge to hang out with the guys and get away from their wives. There are numerical Masons who go there and study and are really obsessed with numerology and occult knowledge of that thing. There are geometrical Masons who are obsessed with angles, shapes, geometry, that kind of thing. There are symbolism Masons who are obsessed with the meanings behind symbols and symbology and what have you. And I forget if there's another kind.
Psychopathic?
No. These are just the different fields and branches of research that Freemasons go into, according to Freda. I only just had it there. There's the linguistic Masons as well, who are obsessed with the languages, the letters, the spellings, and that kind of thing. So, what you've got is you've got 5 different spectra of different interests, different reasons why people are there. Actually, political Masons was the one I was forgetting. Those who are actually there, and this is only one small section of general Freemasonry, who are there to network and gain political power through those networks, because people of power and influence do reside within Masonry. It's by all means not the greatest power hub in all the world, but this is the reason why those people come into it. And again, this stretches the point that some are in it for no good reason at all. Some are in it for occult mysticism reasons, to understand the human condition, and some of them are there because they want to use the organization and its secrecy in their quest for power.
Yeah, that's brilliantly. Yeah, you laid it out just perfectly, I would say. Yeah. I mean, I think there's, yeah, I mean, you're totally right. I mean, I think there's a bunch of Freemasons that get together, want to get rid, you know, be away from their wives and hang out with the boys. Some people are in it for deep occult knowledge, though I think there's a lot. I think there's more and more people like that coming about, but now I think it's more that there's an infestation of that latter, you know, of the political people that want the power, you know. I don't know, though. I'm not a Freemason, so Frater X would know a lot more about this than I would in that, because he's been there. So,
and one of the other elements that James Robert Wright, who's just recently come out, and he did a genealogy test on himself. You wouldn't believe the results that came up, bro. Like,
really?
JFK, Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands, Bill Clinton, just so many. Even Charlemagne, bro. What the? he was all tied in. He sent me like 22 emails. He's even related to Diana, the Princess of Wales, and Prince Charles as well. And he's only just discovered that he's part of all these bloodlines, and he's like freaking out. And what he's done is that he's turned whistleblower on Freemasonry. He was a 32nd degree employed member of the Supreme Council of the 33rd degree in Dallas, the most powerful branch of Freemasonry on Earth, pretty much. Maybe perhaps outside of the network of Nexus in Washington, D.C. However, what he concluded, that the point of the 33 degree systems, normal blue lodges and what have you, they only have 3 degrees, and those are only the basic ones for knowledge of Freemasonry. And what he discovered, or at least what his conjecture is that the 33 degrees are simply rites to ripen up a human soul for demon possession.
Wow, I completely disagree with that. I couldn't disagree with that more.
He's been there, done that, had all these 33rd degree Masons have sexual passes at him, and they were married, and he was gay, and they just knew so, and they wanted to do all of this kind of things. You have Freemason whistleblowers throughout history who just disappear, even get shot in their police cells when they're there, or disappear off the side of the street into a coach for speaking out against Freemasonry. So again, this talks about the element, and there are only 99 33rd degree Freemasons in the entire world. 99, all right? Those are the ones that he believes have in fact been ripened up.
Okay, yeah, so, I mean...
But you'd have to read all the information, actually, probably interview him yourself in order to get that kind of thing there. This is just a bit of a taster for the uninitiated generate some interest for that study, because I would actually like to see the proof of this, you know, but again, this is one person who was there who did that and... has come out and turned whistleblower and has been had his life under threat basically ever since.
Okay, let me say a few things about that, because I would challenge that directly. Now, if there is some like 33 levels of satanic worship or something like that, that is not the original intention of Freemason.
No, absolutely.
Once again, this
not.
Is yeah, this is just the
we're talking about the Scottish Rite specifically.
Oh, yeah.
Because the Scottish Rite was taken up out of Albert Pike's writings. Albert Pike spoke a number of languages, was fairly high up in Freemasonry. He even led a Cherokee Indian battalion or something of that nature in the American Civil War or something. I forget exactly. But apparently, and Freda X has confirmed this, the Scottish Rite is attempting to take over the entirety of Freemasonry. It is taking the understanding of the human condition, history, and occult knowledge, which is actually incredibly powerful knowledge that can in fact be used to free humanity, so
Absolutely.
That they can even occult it even further, keep it to themselves. And I believe one of the things that is evidenced by this is that when History Channel or anybody else ever interviews a Freemason, do they interview a third degree Freemason from a Blue Lodge or anything like that? No, it's always a 33rd degree from somebody from the Scottish Rite, which is only one branch of Freemasonry, albeit it's become the most powerful.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Frederick's new book, I mean, he's working on the war inside Freemasonry, right? So, you know, he's talking about all of these possible different factions that are fighting with one another. And that's that I'm sure that that's going on. No, I mean, without a doubt, because you do have definitely people that are trying to usurp this knowledge and hide it, you know, obfuscate it and keep it from the general public. The thing that I was saying about, James Wright, it was like, well, I'm not trying to call the guy out or anything like that, because I don't know what his story is or anything like that. But I always get really kind of shaky and questionable when somebody says there was an attack or an attempt made on my life. You know, I'm like, because to me, the BS meter starts going wild in my head. Why? Because you're making a claim that somebody made an attack on you that tried to kill you, right? The people that are in power flew planes into building on a mid-morning on a slow Tuesday in front of the damn world. They did this in front of the damn world, and you're telling me that they couldn't get to you. I'm sorry. I have to question that. I'm not saying he's a liar. I'm not trying to call him out. I wish him no malice or ill will or anything like that. You know, I try to go from, you know, by people's word. But that's just the BS meter starts going off.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, if they wanted you dead, you would be dead. You'd be dead like that.
I don't know. I think that there's actually a spiritual element underneath what's happening here, and that if you are walking right with God, amazing, miraculous things happen to prevent your death. Happens all the time. I see evidence of this happening everywhere. And we've got evidence. He's taken a whole bunch of shots of his car that it looks like something exploded from underneath. There was a bullet hole in the wheel axle. And it was actually a white van with tinted windows with a Freemasonic compass and square on the side that followed him on the LA highway on his way down to San Diego. And as he was taking the off ramp, he heard this big bang as the van went past him on the side, and his wheel kind of exploded, and he said that the whole car jumped upwards, like it exploded from underneath or something like that. And when he stopped, he had a Marine run across a parking lot off the side of the highway who saw the accident, and the Marine was actually a listener to my show and knew who James was and stood there to protect him at the time. And I'm just like, can you say Providence? You know, you know, it's an amazing story, and I've documented it, and the videos are on my YouTube channel if you do want to look at it. And his story is like, yeah, biggest Freemasonic whistleblower for over 100 years, and the last person, as I mentioned before, disappeared in a black coach in broad daylight with a Freemasonic compass and square on the side, and was never seen again. So. To say that Masons can kill everybody anytime and what have you, I think, I don't know, if you're doing, you know, the Lord's work, as it were, something always miraculously happens to protect you if you're aware of it, kind of thing. And James has kind of become very, very deeply spiritual as a result of some of these experiences. And I guess you kind of have to become like that. Just psychologically to survive, because like they said, religion's the opiate of the masses, and if you're in a lot of pain spiritually and psychologically, mate, you could be forgiven for taking a few opiates to dull that pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, just to get back to what he was saying, you know, I guess what we're saying about this idea of the 33 and what you know, this is the, you know, whether it's satanic or not, I don't think it is. When you actually look at the number 33. 33 is an important number. Of course, this extends way beyond Freemasonry. This honestly has nothing to do with Scottish Rite Freemasonry. I mean, this goes way, way, way back. So we have to go to the original, you know, just like, I mean, looking at the etymological root of a word to really understand what this means, right? So when you look at the 33, the first thing we have to understand is you have 33 bones in your spinal column, with the spinal column being the central focus of all spiritual doctrine. I mean, the spinal column is, I mean, this is Hinduism, this is Egyptian, this is, you know, et cetera, et cetera. This is raising the Kundalini. This is, we see this in Sumer and Babylonian. This is the Caduceus. This is the staff of Hermes, et cetera, et cetera. This is the seven chakras, of course, with the, once again, the number seven being very important. Well, the reason that you have 32 and 33 degrees in the Scottish Rite Freemasonry, of course, is because this is referencing the fact that you have your cerebral spinal fluid that goes up and down. And this ascension process has been known for a very long time. So, you know, if the Scottish Rite Freemasonry are, you know, because this is associated, so, you know, quote unquote, with their number, whatever, and you and me, everybody is associated with the number 33. Every single person that's listening to this has the number 33 attached to them in some way, because this is directly referring to your spinal column. So when we say, you know, devil worshiping, or this is the, you know, 33 of, you know, whatever, having whatever Satan or whatever, it's, you know, ascend on you or whatever. It's like, I don't know. I think we just have to be very careful with that.
But again, you're oversimplifying it, and it's not just number. Yeah. It's not just the number, because there's rites of passage, rituals, books that you have to read, things you have to recite, and rituals you have to perform through each degree. That's what's ripening it up, not just the number alone.
Yeah. No, I know. I am.
Now, there was also another element as well here. Somebody told me once that the sun is to the power of 33 the size of the earth. Earth to the power of 33 is about the same circumference as the sun, something like that.
That could very well be. I'm not sure. I know the sun's core rotates once every 33 Earth days.
See, there you go. There's another one.
Exactly. I mean, there's a bunch of things with 33 that we can talk
quite
about.
Quite a few.
You know, in fact, the ratio of, you know, if you take, you know, just draw a circle with that's a unit 11, and draw a circle of a unit 3. Well, this is going to be a very, very close, I think, ratio. It's like 99.8% or something like that of the ratio to Earth to the Moon. And of course, 11 times 3 is 33. And so that's it's basically a number that allows you to understand, if you will, universal architecture. So anyway, beyond that, so I guess the thing I wanted to say, what I was trying to say about secret societies is that we have a tendency to demonize these things, and I don't think Freemasonry, once again, or Christianity, or Islam, or any of these things, in its original inception, I think it was to pass on holy information. It was occult information, information about understanding the human condition, and it's only the perversion of these. The other thing I wanted to say is I don't think all the secret societies that have been created were done so for this. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't think Skull and Bones has anything to do with passing on holy information or anything like that. I think this is an extremely corrupt organization that is looking for, taking over the world and globalization and that sort of thing.
So, I'm sure the Republican Party and Democrat Party were founded on the best of intentions too, even though the Constitution specifically warned against creating parties because it would corrupt the country.
Especially when you get into political discussions with people that that are very, once again, it's the dialectic, right? It's it's like two paths to the slaughterhouse kind of thing. Well, people argue about politics all the time. Well, we're not even supposed to be a democracy in the United States here. We're supposed to be a republic.
Yeah.
And so if you get into any political discussion at all, the first thing you should say is, well, do you believe in democracy? What kind of political system do we have here in the United States? Well, democracy. You're wrong. We're not supposed to, because according to the Constitution of the United States, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, we're supposed to be a republic. And a republic it's a libertarian point of view is what it is. It's understanding that every man is a sovereign individual. Every man is free. Every man has the creator, God-given rights.
Mm.
And those things are being usurped.
Even the Congress doesn't know that. One congressman stood up and said, can you name me the three branches of government?
Yeah.
and they said the executive, the judiciary, and the Senate. And he goes, no, actually, it's the states, the people, and the executive, the Congress, the state government, and then there's the people, right? Those are actually the three branches of government, and the people are supposed to rule over the states and the Congress, not Congress rule over the states and the people.
The one thing, since we're talking about this and we're kind of going off
subject
a little bit, but that's all right. It doesn't matter. It's fine. But the one thing that I always get when we talk about the gun control, debate, people are like, well, we got to have certain guns, you can't have guns, you can't have semi-automatics and things like that. It's like, okay, but you're making a distinction between the army, the armed forces, and the people. The people are the armed forces. The people are the government. So when you say, the armed forces can have this, but the people can't, that all you're doing is separating the people from their own government. You're taking the we the people and you're just, throwing it right out the window. Mm. And I haven't heard that in the gun debate at all. It's all about, it's not for hunting, or, the Constitution says this, or, this. Well, no, what you're doing is separating the people from the government. And that is the first problem right there.
Yeah. Now, can you name me a country that banned the use or ownership of weapons that didn't exterminate or enslave their population?
Oh, man. Yeah, isn't it? I mean, it was like Pol Pot and Stalin and like Hitler. All those guys, they took the guns,
all
right?
Even all the way back to freaking Edward the Longshanks told the Scottish they couldn't have swords or bows and arrows or anything like that before he ruthlessly enslaved and tried to exterminate them. Okay?
Oh, really?
Yeah. it's the same deal. And because people don't know the lesson of history, and I think specifically this is why history is kind of one of the dying forms in American education systems, is because it's this important. You can see what people are doing when they're doing it. That's what the lesson of history is. If somebody's banning guns, they want to enslave or exterminate you. It's not complicated.
Yeah, and going back to secret societies, going back to history, if you can, there's that Rage Against the Machine song, Testify. Who controls the past now, controls the future. Who controls the present now, controls the past. If you control the present, you control the past. And if you control the past, people can't have access to what happened. People can't have access to understanding, the guns were taken away, and guess what? Genocide, and that's exactly what's going on. Same thing in Freemasonry. These subversive movements, or whoever these people are, they're infiltrating this group and they're trying to, control that pass and not,
And I actually want to send this message out to current Masons. Your brothers are being corrupted by people who are infiltrating your organization. Okay? We're not saying you're bad. or anything of that nature. We're saying that you're being subverted, that all of the great lessons and everything that is of value within that organization is being captured and destroyed by people who want to destroy your brothers and mine. That's the end of the story. If you want Absolutely. Freemasonry to stop being falsely accused of being corrupt and what have you, then it's quite simple. Find those who are corrupt within the organization and expel them from the orders.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the Freemasonic credos is, I'm going to probably screw this up, but it's like, never look down at a man unless you're giving him a helping hand up, that kind of thing. I mean, that's that at the core, I think that's what, you know, Freemasonry is all about. So, yeah, I couldn't agree more, man. Let me just say this too, is that I got this, my quest through all of this information, which we haven't really even talked about, we'll get into it after this, but my quest through this information was a deeply psychological, deeply spiritual quest that brought me, I'll just be honest and lay my heart on the table here. It, you know, brought me into the hands of the divine, if you will. And that's what I'm teaching now. And so their symbols, their ideas, things like that, and not just Freemasonry. It's a lot of the spiritualities and things like that, and the religions and psychology and all of this stuff, and nature. But you know, one of the things was Freemasonry. And I decoded this with a Freemason symbol. And this has been one of the most amazing, magical, wonderful things that's ever happened to me. So all I can do is look and say, okay, well, if they were passing this information on and they're showing it in their symbols, I can only assume that at the very inception that this was a holy institution, you know? And if you drive into any town in, like, I live in Wisconsin currently, drive into any incorporated town in Wisconsin, you pull in, welcome to Albany, Wisconsin. Welcome to New Glarus, Wisconsin. There's going to be a Freemason symbol right there.
That's actually the same thing if you drive into any town in New Zealand, in some cases, nearly any suburb.
Yeah.
All right. We've come to the end of the first hour now. Marty, sure. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. If you, again, please, ladies and gentlemen, I do need your financial support in order to keep this show running. Rent, power, internet, you know, the whole nine yards and everything like that. It's all coming at me right now. So I would desperately ask and plead for your help to go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, make a donation today, and preferably set up an automatic payment either through PayPal or preferably through that Kiwi Bank account, because they don't take a percentage like PayPal does, for only a few dollars a month, so that we can keep the show running, getting out important ideas, interviewing great thinkers of our time. Incidentally, like Marty Leeds, we'll be right back.
Okay, this one's for Gabby.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two with my very special guest, Marty Leeds. And, yeah, he's kind of like an investigator. That's why they called him Leeds.
Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun.
I'm just like a bad pun machine, you know. Like, in fact, it's funny. I've had at least half a dozen people tell me I should be writing those ridiculously lame Christmas cracker jokes. I think I can make a fortune.
Yeah, you do a lot better than this, huh? Hey, did you see that internet pun that they had with Putin, and he was on a Ritz cracker, and it was Putin on the Ritz? I don't know. It's terrible, but I thought it was hilarious.
Sorry, I don't quite get the joke about the Putin on the Ritz, but...
The Putin on the Ritz, like putting on the Ritz. You know that song that was that song in the '80s, right? Buster Poindexter or something. Was that one? Do you know what I'm saying?
Never.
Oh,
heard
anyway,
it. Might have
so
been.
I guess I shouldn't
time.
Try to make jokes.
I was born in 1984, which is kind of ominous considering my career choice. But yeah,
that's true. Wow.
Okay, so where were we? We've gotten past the old Freemason discussion here. Did you actually go to the point where we even discussed Jesus' name in the cipher and whatnot?
Yeah, you want to go into that? We can. Yeah. So, because basically, what these what these secret societies are holding is, you know, knowledge of what it is to be a human being, the human condition, like you were saying, and what it also is the knowledge that they're holding, especially with gematria. We could go into symbol. Basically, the knowledge base, this occult knowledge base that these secret societies are holding and are trying to pass on are the exact sciences that are being completely dismissed by our modern world, by modern intellectualism, if you will. And these are sciences, symbolism, gematria, astrotheology, numerology, the four key ones there.
You know, this reminds me of what Mark Passio told me about natural law. When he was a priest at the Church of Satan, they very much believe in natural law, but they tell everybody else that natural law doesn't exist because no knowledge of natural law gives you power, and the Church did not want others having that power. So they told everybody the opposite of what they should believe.
Yeah, you know... Mark's last presentation, that New Age BS and the suppression of the sacred masculine, I mean, he just nailed it there. I mean, it was just fantastic. I mean, he just threw the ball up and just knocked it out of the damn park. I mean, the reason that he can lay out this stuff so well, why? Because he studied the occult. He was in it, you know. That's why he knows this stuff so well, because he knows exactly, number one, it's based on natural law. It's based on the natural sciences. And he, of course, he knows how this can be manipulated. And that's why, I mean, it's just a bang-up job. Did you watch the whole 7 hours? Yeah, you did, right? Yeah, it's just fantastic. I mean, I just applaud him. So, anyway.
During the start, maybe this happened to you as well. My neck got sore from nodding so vigorously. In agreement.
It was so funny too. I was like, oh, I'm gonna sit down, I'll watch like 2 hours and then I'll come back to it, you know what I mean? I watched the whole thing. I literally just wasted, that's a terrible term. I spent a really great Saturday watching the whole thing. So
yeah,
fantastic. Anyway. And I got the pleasure to speak with him at the Free Your Mind conference, so that was fantastic too, which those videos should be coming out fairly soon here. I know his was out and I watched that one too, which was great. So anyway, we were talking about, so the knowledge base, this occult or arcane science of old, is basically understanding the sciences that are being dismissed, and that what are called pseudosciences, right? This is the, you know, gematria, symbolism, numerology, astrotheology, right? Well, this is how the Bible is written. I mean, the Bible is written, the entire thing is a symbolic document. You know, I mean, every single line, every single letter, every single story is symbolic of something. It has nothing to do with any sort of exterior or, you know, exoteric idea. It's all mysticism and magic. And so this is what these people are trying to pass on. And of course, this is what's the Bible is being completely perverted by the organized religions of the world, of course, right? They're teaching you a literal story about, especially when you look at the New Testament, about a man named Jesus, and he's going to come flying back in the clouds and save 144,000 of you, right? And if you don't believe him, you're going to drown in a lake of fire or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And none of this is real. None of that is
real. Oh, well, you know, and by the way, we're not telling you this so that you'll blindly follow every single thing that we say and give us 10% of your income. No. It's because we actually give a frack about you while we live in the $2.7 million mansions that our church leaders live in. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing nefarious going on here, ladies and gentlemen. Just believe us, okay? That's what we're asking for, is belief and your money, okay?
Oh, so convenient that they're a tax shelter too. You know?
Like, oh yeah,
with their gold-plated thrones and yeah. It's just nuts. So.
Yeah. See, I feel that religion's been corrupted the same way that Freemasonry did, has been to a degree, don't you think? That there's real benefit within those religions, but the problem is because psychopaths always crave positions of power and control, they always wind up manipulating or stabbing their way into positions of power and control, and then basically subvert and invert the intentions of everything.
Yeah, and especially, I mean, you're totally right, because, you know, like the Christianity, Islam, you know, all of these things, and Freemasonry, they are holding real knowledge, and that is exactly why they were infiltrated, why they, you know, they corrupted these organizations. I mean, to me, it's like, you know, these organizations originally were like, you know, your sweet grandma or something, you know, and then she got cancer, and then we look at your grandma, and it's like, oh, she's the devil, you know, or something like that, you know. But really, she's just a sweet lady. She bakes you apple pies and pinches your cheeks and gives you $50 every Christmas, you know, that sort of thing. So probably not the greatest analogy, but you get the point. So this is what these knowledge. Did you get me? Sorry.
not quite, but moving on.
Okay. Keep going. Yeah. This is why I don't host shows. Yeah. So yeah. They're holding the real knowledge of the Bible. Right. So let's take a look at the New Testament and let's take a look at Jesus Christ. We know all you have to do is, you know, just have a little bit of common sense, realize that this is allegory, that this is symbolism, that this is riddle, and that if you read any of these old texts, whether it's George Carey or Carl Anderson or Alvin Boyd Kuhn or, you know, even guys like Manly P. Hall and things like that, you'll know that Jesus Christ is a myth, a sun god myth. And this is a myth that's based around the processes and cycles of the sun. So. Of course, we have the myth of where the sun stops moving south on the horizon on December 21st, essentially, and the sun stops moving south, it's dead for 3 days, and then the sun rises again. And this is, of course, the motif of Jesus being nailed on the cross being the solstices and equinoxes. He was laid in a tomb for 3 days, and then he was resurrected. And of course, there's millions of people across the world that believe this stuff, right? As literalist. Well, then you see that, okay, this is an allegory for the sun, Jesus Christ. So, using this science, this gematria, this artistic science, if you will, what we can do is go into the name of Jesus Christ and find very particular numbers attributed to the sun in our sky, metrological numbers, numbers that dealing with like botany, astronomy, things like that. And we're going to go into all this. So, Jesus Christ. Once again, here's the cipher. A through M, N through Z. You can literally just put it right on top of one another and go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, resting on the G and T, and then 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So Jesus, as it's spelled in the English, let me stop a second. I'm going to need to say this. I need to make this very clear. The only Bible that's worth its salt, the only Bible that really should be read when looking into this is the Authorized King James Holy Bible, period. Because this is a Masonic edition Bible. This is the Authorized King James Version. That's why that's on that cover right there, because it's saying that the people that translated this from the original Greek scriptures knew of the mathematics behind it, and they were translating it with this understanding, and they understood the symbolism, the mythology, the numerology, the astrotheology, the psychology and philosophy behind it. All of the other versions of Bibles that are being printed today, whether it's God's Word version, the New Living Translation, any of these are complete distortions and bastardizations of the original text. That needs to be clarified, because when you read those, especially reading them mathematically, when you read those, you will see that they are nothing alike. Even Genesis 1:1 is perverted in a lot of these books. And I just need to make that clear. So if you are going to look into this, do not even bother with any of those others, because they didn't know it. They didn't know that there was mathematics behind it. So let's go into Jesus Christ. Lead character of the New Testament, of course, the savior of the Christian religion. Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So Jesus is 456666. Of course, we have the number 666 right in the name of Jesus. Of course, St. John in 13:18 says, here is wisdom, let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is a number of man, and his number is 666. And St. John is very clearly saying in that verse that 666 is a number of wisdom and a number of man. It's a number of you. And the beast in that verse is the beast that rises in the east. It's the enormous sun. It's the ball of light that we revolve around. And so it's a number of wisdom. So the fact that we find the number 666 in the name of Jesus is very important. So I'm going to just go to Christ quick here. Is Christ is C-H-R-I-S-T, and this is 365567. Okay, I'm just going to say that. So let's go to Jesus first. Let's take a look at Jesus. Jesus, if, just as you look on your phone, when you look on your phone right now, you have nine numbers spread out, and it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Right? This motif you actually find in what's known as the Christian angelic hierarchy. And it was this nine angels, and they were split up into three levels, just like you see on your phone once again. Well, if you add these numbers across, 1 + 2 + 3 = 6, 4 + 5 + 6 = 15, and 1 + 5 = 6, and 7 + 8 + 9 = 24, and 2 + 4 = 6. So therefore, you're getting literally the number 1 through 9, 6, 6, 6. And if you add 1 + 2 + 3 + 4 + 5 + 6 + 7 + 8 + 9, it equals 45. So just as it's seen on your phone, just as it's seen in the Christian angelic hierarchy, this stems from the Greek and Egyptians, of course, you get the numbers 4, 5, and 6, 6, 6. And this is how you break up the name Jesus syllabically. Jesus, 4, 5, 6, 6, 6. So what that is basically the crux of numerology. I'm not going to really go into it here, but that's what it's showing in his name. So what we're going to do is multiply Jesus, right? So Jesus is 4, 5, 6, 6, 6, just as we just said. 4 × 5 × 6 × 6 × 6 is a number 4,320. Well, this number 432 is extremely important. And what you can do is look at how important this number is in different scales. So for instance, the number 432 in somatics, which is the science of looking at hertz or wavelengths and seeing geometric forms that arise from this. Did you have something to say?
I was actually just about to say the 432 hertz frequency is like a healing energy.
Yeah, and this really stems from looking at visually, seeing that there are symmetrical or geometric forms that arise when we hit certain frequencies. And what this is showing is that there, especially when you understand that nature is built with geometry and number, that you can see that 432 becomes very important. So we see 432 in somatics. So this number 432 at different scales. So we can look at 432 in somatics. The degree of phylotaxis, and we're going to get back into this in the name of Christ. The degree of phylotaxis is a degree in which leaves will arrange themselves around a plant, right? So if you look at a plant, you'll see that the leaves will not overlap each other, that they'll arrange each other as they swirl up around the plant, around a flower, whatever, in a very particular way. And this degree is measured at 137.5 degrees. Well, 137.5 degrees, a constant in nature, multiplied by pi, one of the most important mathematical constants, gives you the number 432.025. So we can see constant in nature, constant in mathematics. All we did is use the holy cross of multiplication, and we came up with 432. So once again, it goes beyond the opinion or idea of man of what we think about it. That's just nature. For 4,320, we're just going to look at it at a different scale. 4,320. 4,320 is two precessional ages in what's known as the precession of the equinoxes, right? It's this great span of time. I'm sure you know about it. A lot of people got hip to it because of 2012, known as the Yuga cycle in Hindus. The Greeks, they had it as the Platonic cycle or the great year. Well, what it was is basically this great span of time of 25,920 years. Well, two precessional ages would be 4,320. Once again, just a different scale of 432. 43,200. Once again, just going to go up another octave, if you will, in the base 10 system, if you will. 43,200. Well, this is just the seconds in a half day. So 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour, 12 hours in a half day. 60 times 12 is 43,200. What else? The Great Pyramid of Giza is a scale model of one hemisphere of the Earth. And if we take the Great Pyramid of Giza and we multiply it by 43,200, its base is going to sit on the equator, and where the missing capstone is on the top would hit the North Pole. So once again, all based on this number 432. Now we can go to 43,200, right? Once again, just going up in scale. This is the radius of the sun. And of course, we are dealing with the Son of God, and this is all found in the name of Jesus. So that's just the name of Jesus. We haven't even got to Christ yet, mind you. Christ. Christ is C-H-R-I-S-T, being 365. 365, how many days in the solar year are there? 365. Of course, we're dealing with the sun. And then the next three numbers are 5, 6, 7. I-S-T is 5, 6, 7. 5 + 6 + 7 is 18. And Jesus went missing for 18 years in the Holy Bible, in the New Testament. He goes missing at age 12, goes missing 18 years. We have no idea what happened to him. All of a sudden, he shows back up at 30. So 18 is a very important number. Why? Because he went missing at age 12, and started his ministry at age 30. Well, there's 12 ages of the zodiac and 30 degrees of each age. 12 times 30 is 360 degrees of a circle. And of course, this is the 12 months of the year. This is the seasons of our year. And so that's all encoded within the mythology, and not only the mythology, but also his name. So what we can do is multiply Christ now. So 3 times 6 times 5 times 5 times 6 times 7 is this number 18,900. So we took the numbers of Christ, we multiplied them. We get this number 18,900. Who cares, right? What does 18,900 mean to you? Nothing. Now take the square root of 18,900, and we get the degree of Philotaxis, 137.48. 137.5 is the degree.
Isn't that what the IRS makes us do?
What's that?
Philotaxis?
Damn, you're quick, man. the fact that this is encoding in his name. Oh, where does this come from? What does this have to do with Freemasonry, right? 137.5 is the degree of Philotaxis. Well, this is open to 47 degrees, and this is, of course, a square. We all know a square is 90 degrees.
So 90, for the radio listeners, he's pointing at the Masonic compass and square, and the compass is open at 30 degrees, and the square is at 90 degrees, yeah.
Sorry. I apologize for that. I forgot that people weren't watching this. So yeah, the compass is actually open to 47 degrees.
47, sorry.
Yeah, no problem. And then the square is open to 90 degrees. So 90 plus 47 is, of course, 137. You're only 0.5 off. And so not only do we find this name in the degree of Philotaxis, we find this degree in the name of Christ. We find it associated with 432, and then we find it right on the cover of the Holy Bible, right? And then in the Freemason symbol. So by the way, on the back of the $1 bill, so the compass was open to 47 degrees. That angle of that pyramid, guess what angle it's at?
47.5 degrees? No.
47. Yeah, okay. So exactly.
Well, and also there's a lot of encoded numerology in the back of the $1 bill as well. I think like there's an eagle holding 13 arrows and it's holding an olive leaf branch that has 13 leaves on it, and I forget the rest of them, but apparently there's the number 13 repeats itself on the $1 bill 13 times.
Yeah. And of course, we split our alphabet in the letters into 13 letters and 13 letters, two blocks of 13, right? The Great Pyramid of Giza, which is what is being shown on the Eye of Providence or the All-Seeing Eye of God. Well, the Great Pyramid of Giza is 13 square acres, I guess, something like that, I want to say. So, you see this repeated 13, 13. And the reason is because, once again, this is all cryptically encoding things that are within our alphabet. By the way, get back to this. Jesus was the Lord, right? Jesus is Lord. L-O-R-D is 2254. This equals 13. God, the two names that we find in the Holy Bible, G-O-D is 724. This equals 13. So Lord and God equal 13. We split our alphabet in 13 and 13 letters. Of course, Jesus Christ is 12 around 1, which means that his posse was 13 dudes. You know, so all of this stuff is, once again, numerical. It's numerological. So getting back to Christ. Jesus is 27, so 4, 4, 5, 6, 6, 6 equals 27, and Christ is 32. Well, 27 plus 32 is 59. There are 59 beads in a Christian rosary. So there's this rosary that people have. There are millions of these. My mother has one, and I think she got it from her mother, and her mother got it from her grandma. So very old rosary has this very specific number. So we have these people that are going to church every single day. They're kneeling down. They're listening to this pastor, minister, preacher, whatever it is, and they're sending their thoughts out to this man named Jesus who's going to come and save them. And they're holding this rosary that has 59 beads, having absolutely no idea why there are 59 beads in this rosary. And we do the numerology of Christ with a cipher begotten from the Holy Bible, mind you, and we find 59. Pretty interesting. Jesus equals 27. This is the kicker. Jesus equals 27. Christ equals 32. 27 times 32 is 864. And the diameter of the sun in English miles is 864,000 miles. So here we have the Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and we look, and it equals 864. Interesting thing, the there's a the, you know, the Toltec complex, Teotihuacan. They have it's Mesoamerica. They have this huge complex, and they have two pyramids, and one's called the Pyramid of the Sun, and the other one's called the Pyramid of the Moon. Well, this whole complex is built with what's known as STUs and standard Teotihuacan units. Well, the Pyramid of the Sun is built with 864 of them, and that's just the measurement. So we have this Toltec complex that's referencing the sun. 864, we go to the sun, it equals 864,000 miles, and then we look at Jesus Christ, and we multiply his name, and it equals 864.
Mm.
Now, yeah, and
well, see,
mind
that's
you,
the scale of STU, but you tell that to an academic, and they'll just tell you to STFU.
Yeah, that's about it, right? Yeah, I mean, I don't know, because, I mean, I'm basically ignored by all academia. I mean, no, I'm pretty much unknown to these people, so I don't know what they would actually think about it.
Like, but if you weren't ignored by academia, I think it would damage your credibility or something, you know? Yeah. It's just like, academics listen to this guy, oh, he must be full of crap, you know?
Yeah. So, oh, by the way, sun in the cipher... Right? We talked about Lord being 13, God equaling 13. Sun is S-U-N. It's 661. This equals 13. So, once again, so the idea of all of this stuff being a coincidence, right, first and foremost, is absurd. It's absurd. It really is. I mean, I would challenge anybody to say that this is a coincidence, because that defies the very definition of what a coincidence is. You're talking about very specific numbers. First of all, I would need to say this. Anybody can do this math. I just explained the cipher. You can go to my site and look at the cipher. You can go and write this down and double check all of this math yourself. And I encourage you to do that. I really encourage you to do that, because I don't want you to trust me. I want you to be able to do it by yourself. And you don't need to believe me. You don't need to buy my book in order to do this. You just need to go and take some time to do it. Instead of watching CSI Miami tonight or whatever the hell it is you were going to watch, you know, go and check this out, you know.
Incidentally, so, I asked a Freemason friend of mine the other day, like, he works on construction sites and stuff, and I asked him, any of the new kids that are coming in to do all the construction work, can any of them do even basic maths without using a calculator? And he's like, no, not at all. So I think you're wrong, Marty. Not everybody can do this maths.
You're right. That's a good point. Well, if you have a calculator, you can do this math anyway, so... But really, I mean, when you look at it, it's all add, subtract, multiply, and divide. I mean, it's not even subtracting or dividing. It's just adding and, well, think about it this way, too. It's adding and multiplying. That's all we just did. We did, besides square rooting once, we added and multiplied. That's all we did. What are the symbols for add and multiply? They're crosses. You know, so you see how deep the symbolism goes. It's, you know, it's no joke. I mean, these people took numerology very seriously. And so whoever crafted the name of Jesus Christ, when they were translating it from, once again, from that original Greek, were very, very intelligent. They were extremely intelligent.
Is that why when people take his name in vain, they get very cross about it?
Let's talk about the spiritual meaning of Jesus Christ, if you will. And what I got from it, and this is, I'm so glad you actually said that, because when you take the Lord's name in vain, two names of the God, or two names for God, just as we just said in the Holy Bible, right? Lord and God. Well, Abraham, who founded the Abrahamic religions, right? Islam, Judaism, Christianity, he was a monotheist, right? I mean, that's what the whole idea is, that there's one God, right? And then, of course, the Islam say, well, that's our God. That's our interpretation. There's Judaism, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then, we have all this infighting. The thing with the one God is that there's two names in the Bible. Well, if there's two names for God in the Bible and there's only one God, why would he have two names? What's the point of that? It doesn't make any sense, any logical sense. If there's one God, he should have one name, right? There's a reason for this, and there's a spiritual reason for this. This is talking about the fact that we find this same thing in Hinduism. In Hinduism, there was known as Brahman and Atman. Brahman was the cosmic God. It was the whole thing. It was as far out as your thoughts could go, as far out as we can see into the universe. It's all it was, shall be, and is. It's omnipotent, omniscient, omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent. It's everything.
So are you talking about the difference between what God is, God encompassing everything, and then the difference being the will of God, right? Lord is the will of God and God is everything kind of thing. Is that sort of where you're getting at?
No. Let me try to clarify this. So God, the term of God, we're going into Hinduism here. I'm sorry. Brahman is the cosmic God. Brahma literally means cosmos. That's what it means. So it means everything. Atman was the God that was at man. It's the God that dwelled within the human temple. And so there was two aspects of this wholeness of God, the monotheistic, and monotheism is extremely important. And it's not the God of the Islams or the Jews or the Christians or the Muslim, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's not any of those gods. It's the idea that there's a oneness and a wholeness and an interconnectivity to our entire universe. And this is the Brahman. This is the cosmos. And then that Brahman focuses on one central conscious point, and that conscious point is the conscious point of the human being. And that is the Atman. The exact same thing is being expressed in the Holy Bible. God is the whole. It's the wholeness. It's everything. It's all it was, shall be, and more is, etc., etc., right? And the Lord is the Lord within. And so the Lord Jesus Christ is to recognize the Christ consciousness within. It's to recognize the elevated spirit of the human being. So not taking the Lord thy God is how it's said in the Bible. The Lord thy God's name in vain is to say, there's a deeper meaning here. It's saying, do not take your own name in vain. Do not devalue yourself. Do not look, you know what I mean? Recognize that you have that divine consciousness within you, and don't devalue yourself. Recognize that eternal spirit within. And that is the spiritual message behind this.
Well, isn't that what vanity is only appreciating what's on the outside and ignoring what's on the inside? Hence taking the Lord's name in vain, taking your insides and making it vanity.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why it's the idea. And the idea of, you also hear the idea of fearing God, right? Or you're fearing the Lord. The first step is to fear the Lord. Well, what are you talking about? To fear, you're going to fear yourself? Well, guess what? Anything that's worth doing, when you start to do it, there's fear, right? There's trepidation. First time I ever stepped on stage as a musician, I was scared blankless. You know what I mean? The first step in overcoming something is to fear it. I've sat at the bottom of a 12,000-foot mountain with 60 pounds on my back and looked up and been like, oh, my God, am I going to bust a knee? Am I going to get up there? Am I going to wuss out? You know what I mean? And there was fear. And then what do you have to do? Overcome it. That's what you have to do. So this is as soon as you penetrate all of that literalism, there's a really, really deep spiritual message there. And this is the things that is being completely polluted by, once again, the Freemasons, the Vatican, etc.
Now, the manipulation of humans through marketing, I just interviewed Suzanne Posel from the USIndependent.com yesterday, and she said they try to keep you in marketing in four states of being, either fear, rage, alcohol, and I think there was one other, or drugs. Yeah, alcohol or drugs, fear or rage, and those are the only four things that they try to promote through marketing, more or less. Those are the states that they wish you to be in. They either want you doped up, drunk as hell, afraid, or enraged, right? Those are the only things you can easily manipulate people under those circumstances. If somebody's afraid, you can tell them what to be afraid of and point them in that direction. Somebody's angry, you can tell them what to be angry at and point them at the direction. If somebody's drunk, you can show them there's a toilet to throw up in and point them in that direction, and so on and so forth. And I believe that the manipulation of the human race is as old as time itself. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's actually almost, it's a power base. Knowing how humans work, knowing what our influences are, and more to the point, knowing when we're under the influence so that you can inject your influence into this. And I know this from personal experience because I don't know about you, Marty, but every now and again I do get the opportunity to go out and you know, boogie on the dance floor and have a few drinks with a few people and what have you. And sober, these people who I speak to will call me a conspiracy theorist, will call me crazy and what have you. Drunk or stoned, on the other hand, they listen to my ideas with interest, they offer their own insights and what have you. It's this total polar shift in the ability for them to be receptive to information that they would ordinarily reject, and I think that's what marketing really is.
Yeah, as far as like drug use and things like that, or any sort of like let me step back a second. Since we were on the spiritual thing, this idea of feeding those lower animal natures, the atavistic carnal natures, we can understand this through the chakra system. And this, you don't even have to bring any woo-woo stuff into this. There's an understanding that the endocrine system that is attached to your spine, that your brain sends the cerebrospinal fluid and it sends information out there, right? Well, anything that's lower than the heart chakra, right? Anything that's lower than the heart is, in Hinduism, it's the Muladhara, the Svanasana, and the Manapura. These are your lower animal natures. So the people that are advertising to us are trying to feed us that stuff. They're saying, feed that gut, feed that sexual drive. Here's a bunch of alcohol that's going to go right into your stomach. They don't talk about the heart. They don't talk about the mind. They don't talk about elevating the spirit. You'll never get that from advertising. Why? Because they know that that's what they're feeding. So there's a spiritual component even to that, an understand. And that is, by the way, the seven chakras are just littered in revelation. I mean, it's all over the Bible in many respects, but that's all revelation is about, is the psychology of lifting the self up into the divine and recognizing one's own sovereignty, spirituality, and that you are crafted by that great creator being. That's a nature force, if you will. That's Allah, Mu, Jehovah, Jah, Ra, whatever you want to believe. It's not any name for God, by the way, falls remarkably and ridiculously short in identifying it or defining it. You can't define it, So I just wanted to say that, but that's what the advertisers are doing. They're feeding to those lower animal natures, and we want to lift that up, and we want to lift it with our hearts up into and illuminate ourselves. So
now you were talking about the chakra systems and how revelations actually goes into those and explains. I'm curious. Could you explain?
Yeah. How do I want to go into this? The number seven is extremely important. Every time you see the number seven, just like this, the system that of our language is built off seven. Anytime you see seven, it really, what it's talking about is not just the chakra system. It's talking about the relationship that man has to his environment. Right? There's six directions of space: forward, reverse, up, down, left, and right. And those six directions of space come onto a confluence, and that's a center point, and that center point is the seventh point. And that seventh point is the consciousness of the human being. This is the X, Y, and Z axis, with their opposites and directions coming in. And this is, so it's understanding the three-dimensional mathematics of you. That's what it's understanding, and how you, go about in the world and do your business. And this is the motif that we see in the very opening pages of Genesis. God did his work in 6 days and rested on the seventh. And people take this literally, like God actually, formed the world in day one and then, day two. And what it's really talking about is the three-dimensional mathematics of the Lord, or the great divine character that is you. Mm. So it's beyond just the chakras. Now, if I may say this, so I don't lose my thought here anyway, our entire world is built off seven. Not only do we have seven chakras, seven points of the endocrine system, our three-dimensional mathematics and resting on a center point, which is known as the axis point. Axis is an anagram for six. Is the alpha. It's you. Our whole world is built off seven. The human being, as far as I know, is the only creature that actually sees a rainbow. Rainbow is seven colors. The planets that we can see in our sky is of sevenfold nature. The heavenly spheres. Sun, Mercury, Venus, Moon, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, seven planets. These were seven planets known by shamans and alchemists of all time, So what we can see in our sky is of a sevenfold nature. So we have the rainbow, we have the seven notes of the major scale, seven deadly sins, etc. So anytime you see the number seven, I could just pick up Revelation. Actually, I need a smaller version because I don't want to pick this up. But you just read Revelation and you will see seven again, seven, 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 again and again. And this is what it's talking about, is about this number is an integral part of understanding what it is to be a human being. The number seven, S-E-V-E-N, 6-5-5-5-1 equals 22. And 22 divided by 7 is 3.142. It's pi. So that's how understanding numerology and the qualitative aspect of numbers can help you understand your environment. And this is why, honestly, numerology is so important. Numerology just means ology, meaning the study of, and numer, meaning number. That's all it means, man. So you're telling me that how many people would be like, oh, he's a numerologist, don't listen to him. Well, all I'm doing is studying number. What's so wrong with that? As far as I'm concerned, That's mathematics. Do you know who else was a numerologist? Pythagoras, one of the greatest mathematicians of all time, and he was well known to be a mystic and a numerologist. So hopefully that answers that question anyway.
It does, actually. Now, of course, this goes back into, and I hate to repeat this, the occulting of knowledge, to secret it away. And I believe that I'm, as Mark Passio described himself as well, a de-occultist. We're attempting to de-occult this knowledge, to give it out to people. I remember that the accumulation of power, in order to accumulate it for yourself, you need to take it away for others. Now, in order for everybody to share this knowledge, it means everybody would be powerful and I wouldn't be able to have power over any of them. And this is the... I think this is the important perspective of our time, in fact, to believe that power should be shared, not monopolized.
Yeah, I mean, that's my goal. I want to teach this stuff to people because I know that I'm not manipulated anymore by any sort of advertising. I mean, it's the idea of waking up and really what it is. And when you understand this, especially the occult body of knowledge, you can't be manipulated by it because you're smart enough to know what they're doing. You know, I was working one time and I was with my friend and we were putting up this sign and there was this big old McDonald's billboard, right? And it was big old red, and there was this girl, she was probably between 18 and 21, you know, that real, you know, young age, just to have enough, just old enough to have sex with, but, you know, young enough and still sexy, and her breasts are just laid out, and she's holding this big old Big Mac or something like that, and this big red billboard, and I was talking to her, but I'm looking at this, and I'm like, all they're doing right now is feeding these lower animal carnal natures. Here's the food. Here's the sex. Here's the, and then of course even the color red. If you understand, you know, even
passion,
a little bit
the woman
about,
in the red dress. You know, the distraction,
absolutely.
The deceiver.
You know? And so, how many people will look at that and just pass right by it? It'll enter their conscious, enter their subconscious, and have no recognition of it whatsoever. I see that, and I'm like, oh, that's straight-up manipulation. And people can learn that.
I only just had this realization the other day, is that advertisements are starting to drive me nuts, and I ain't even watching no TV anymore. I barely even listening to any radio. But still, advertisements are everywhere. They're all down the columns of your Facebook. They're on billboards on the side of the road, bus stations. Everything is freaking advertising. You get all these damn things in your letterbox and everything. And I figured, and just as you're saying it now, I figured out why it's driving me so freaking mad. It's because I'm allergic to being manipulated. I really hate being manipulated. And I know that I'm consciously aware that it's trying to manipulate me. That's why I hate it so much. Even a little bit in my face just pisses me off.
Yeah, allergic to being manipulated. That's a great way to put it, by the way. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. A lot of times the people that are awake or a lot of the people that are listening to the show that are like hip to a lot of this stuff, you know, I think we have a tendency to live in a bubble in many respects. It's like, according to my Facebook page, everybody's awake. Everybody, you know, tomorrow it's going to be a wonderful world. But when I live in southern Wisconsin right now and I can't talk to anybody about this stuff, anybody. I mean, no one wants to listen to it. Even if I start getting into any sort of spiritual ideas or not even any of that, just numerology, like the phalanges of your hand, understanding that the sections here of your hands have to do with universal mathematics. That's they don't want to listen to that, you know? And so I feel like it's almost a full-time job for me to try to put out as much information to try to get to grab the ear of as many people as I can while I'm still here and have breath in my lungs, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is actually the power of the internet. And one of these realizations I had was it last night or this morning, I forget, but it occurred to me that when you wake up to the truth about really anything, any deep occult knowledge and the way the world truly works and what have you, it's like taking your old self and your old part of the world and surgically removing it from you, and that's inherently traumatic. And what's worse is that it compounds onto that, because not only do you realize that your entire life has been full of crap and all of this stuff has passed you by up until this point, so that you actually kind of have to start again. It's like high school was a waste of time, so was kindergarten, so was your parents' teachings. Almost everything that you've ever done in your entire life has been for naught. That in itself is an inherently traumatic realization. What's even worse than that is when you're surrounded by people who have not yet had that realization themselves, who think that you're crazy for having it, and they ostracize you, they demonize you, and you feel really alone, and you feel really depressed about the fact that you're really alone, and you feel really angry about the people who are ostracizing you and demonizing you, and then you get worse and worse and worse. And it occurred to me that this is the point of my show, to just offer my hand out and offer my ears and the sounds of my voice to help all of those people who went through that same traumatic wake-up experience, all of those of you who are feeling alone right now, who your family call you nuts and what have you. This show is for you. It's not to wake people up who haven't had this experience. This is not for the uninitiated. These are the people who have gotten over themselves to the point where they just need to know how to cope with the information. Somebody asked me the other day, Vinny, what do I do once I've learned all this information? I go, well, it's a three-step process, okay? Well, four steps if you include the waking up in the first frickin' place. Step two is learning how to deal with the fact that you know this information now, okay? Coping with it. Humor's a good tool for that. It's by no means the only one. You can also get drunk every day and stoned every day. It's the only way to tell
that.
and a lot of us do go through that process before we start to develop other coping mechanisms, because you realize that if you're using a coping mechanism which destroys your mind and or your body, it's not exactly a sustainable one. And then step three and four, figure out how you alone can contribute to making a difference. That's step three, and then step four is actually making that difference. And that's the pinnacle anybody can ever achieve in their life, is to change something that actually affects the human race in a positive way.
It's one of the noblest of deeds, you know. So, I mean, you know what you're saying here with step three and four, it's just right on. I mean, it really is. I mean, if you can, once again, that goes back to that Freemasonic credo. It's like you never look down on another human being unless you're giving him a hand up, you know. How many researchers out? This is something that I've been really. You just posted this on your Facebook page about being, you know, kind of alone or whatever. Did you, like, in the last week or something like about that? About how your people are not understanding you and they're calling you a conspiracy theorist, and then it kind of puts you in this closet or whatever, you know, kind of puts you in the shadows. And I mean, that's why, I mean, the internet is such a powerful tool about reaching out to people. And I think that as people that are de-occulting this stuff or whatever, or bringing this information out, I think we have a responsibility to our fellow man. I think we have a moral obligation to our fellow man. And I don't know, I just need to say this, man, because this has really been just ticking me off. I could name probably 10 or 15 really good researchers, people that have read a lot of books, done really a lot of really good research, that are, you know, have podcasts or whatever. They've done lectures and all of this stuff. And they're really intelligent people. And yet, people will come to their Facebook page or their YouTube page, and they'll disagree with something that they say, or they'll challenge on something that they say, and their initial reaction is, moron, idiot, you know? Well, that's not helping anything, because guess what, man? You were that moron at one point. You were that ignorant person at one point. You were that fool at one point. And to put all you're doing by doing that is putting your former self down. That's all you're doing. So we have an obligation not to act like that, you know, to follow the golden rule. And treat people as you would want to be treated, and to help lift them up, to teach the ignorant, to tolerate the intolerance, knowing that if we can keep working and reclaim this thing from the people that have taken control of it. If you know what I'm saying, I mean, I think that's a very important point, you know. I gotta say, thank you for what you're doing, by the way.
That said, there's a balance to that equation as well, because not only are you trying to help up your potential allies and what have you, is you also have to expose and indeed help to disempower those who are actually the enemies of humanity, psychopaths and whatnot. No amount of knowledge will stop a psychopath from being a psychopath. They won't wake up one day and just suddenly go, oh my god, I'm a completely psychotic pedophile ring running scumbag and I feel really bad about it. They can't do that psychologically. They're part of their brain that has that emotion, that has that self-realization, that recognition of morality doesn't exist. It's not physically there in these people. And the real problem, as I mentioned in the first hour, is that these people wind up in power of our institutions in and of themselves. This is why I, as we were talking about before, like when I was criticizing Freemasonry, you interpreted it very, very quickly as anybody who believes in the integrity of a general section of any institution instantly reject any criticism of the entire institution as a whole, because it's seen as criticizing every single person within that institution, whereas it's not that case. However, we can recognize that an institution has been corrupted from a very, very small minority at the top, and people are perfectly capable of accepting that level of criticism rather than throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And that's part of what I'm starting to learn to do, is differentiate between attacking an institution that is full of people and simply attacking individuals within that institution that are full of crap.
I would add this, and the really good thing that's on our side is most people are not psychopaths.
Yes.
You know, that's what's the really great thing. And so I guess what when I was saying that, let me clarify this, is that when somebody comes to a YouTube page or a Facebook page or whatever, it makes those, chances are that person is not a psychopath. They're just ignorant. They're just naive. They just haven't woken up, or they just haven't learned things yet. And so I think it's our responsibility to teach them, at least lay them out, lay out information for them, at least be kind to them. You know, yeah, there are psychopaths, and there's nothing you're going to do about it. You know, that's just the roll of the dice and just what happens. You know, I also would say this. I don't think that you. This comes from, Robert Buckminster Fuller. You never change things by fighting the existing reality. You change things by making a new model, which makes the old model obsolete. And so my goal, is not to necessarily, not that there's anything necessarily wrong with protesting or anything like that, because I know you're a big protester or anything like that, but I want to build the new model. And just let this thing shine, and then people like, okay, that makes a whole lot more sense. And, you know, help build that as opposed to try to cut down the people. Because if there are so many more of those real people that are searching for answers, they're going to be drawn to that new model as opposed to me spending all my breath and time trying to attack that 1% that, you know what I mean, that runs the world. You know, I think I think unification and not necessarily agreeing with everybody or anything like that, but I think declaring our independence en masse is going to do way more than ever than, you know, the protesting or, you know, that sort of thing is going to work, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, see, yesterday I declared war on the corrupt media institutions in this country, and I specifically said that I believe that there are elements within the media in New Zealand that are corrupt, that do distort stories, and do, in fact, refuse to help those who need their stories told. And I'm declaring war on that particular section of the New Zealand media. Not all New Zealand media, not all New Zealand blogosphere, just on those who basically are self-identified manipulators.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, what you're doing is really great, because not only are you saying, hey, look at those people that are corrupt, look at those people that are manipulating the news, look at that, but you're also providing another service to say, hey, here's the other side, here's the new model. And how many people are drawn to this new model, right? I mean, you have more listeners than the media, don't you?
What's real funny is one of the biggest left-wing bloggers in this country criticized the protest that I was on and said, oh, I've seen better numbers at a chemtrail protest. And incidentally, I've led those chemtrail protests. So he was publicly taking a dig at me in a kind of underhanded sort of way. And he got... I think 2 likes on that Facebook post. I put 1 post criticizing the media, and it's up to like 80 likes. So here's the thing. This is a realization that I came to a number of years ago before I even really started to get to this level that I am now, is that you win by fighting back. Okay? And in so doing... we've already won, haven't we? Because we are fighting back. All we're doing is going through the motions here. We're seeing the death of the scumbaggery, and we're seeing new life being energized into those with, as Mark Passio calls it, a moral obligation to do good, a moral obligation to think for ourselves. And my brother argued with me on this. I said that if you're fighting for freedom... by default, you are fighting against tyranny. And this is where that Eckhart Tolle kind of thing comes in. You know, don't fight the existing system, make a new system that has it obsolete. I believe that by making a new system, you automatically are fighting against the old system, because the old system will attack you to protect itself, won't it? So not only have you got to create a new system, but you also have to come up with a defensive tactic in order to prevent your new system from being destroyed by the old one, which will wish to suppress anything that challenges its current dominance, whether that be psychological or physical or political.
Yeah, I mean, and the old system is falling. You know, it really is. I mean, major media, news media is just terrible. And I think people, I mean, the only people that really watch it anymore are starting to age. You know, I mean, even my parents are getting to hip to the fact that it's like, you know, Brian Williams doesn't have anything important to say. All he's doing is reading a teleprompter and telling them, you know, telling people what he's told to say, you know, and people are recognizing that. I mean, if you didn't have the major media, right, where would people get their news? Well, they would have to go to all of these different independent sources that are free to say whatever they want, save for the FCC, which is, once again, the FCC in control, right, by the government. I mean, what are they doing? What are they doing? They're spellbinding us. You can't say certain words. Why? Why not? Well, because we say. So we're going to control the language, and we're going to control what you can say. Mm. So we even got to get rid of that, because that's just nonsense.
I have a message for the FCC. F you!
My acronym is one letter short, bro.
You know, I can't really put it in more succinct words than that. You know, it's pretty straightforward, isn't it?
Yeah. And this idea of, once again, we're talking to get back to gematria a little bit, and talking about words and word manipulation and really spellbinding people. That's really, I mean, the Holy Bible is called the Gospel, which is nothing more than the ghost spell. That's what it's saying, you know. Seances or sentences, sibyls come from syllables, you know, this sort of idea. Rites come from writing. The fact that our language binds us in so many different ways. The FCC is just one example of that. But our language binds us in so many ways. I mean, look at legalese, right? I mean, you have an entire dictionary that's created, that's redone like every single year, right?
To make it's very ironic that they call it legalese, because there's nothing easy about it. It's quite difficult, in fact. Yeah.
I mean, think about this. I mean, you have all of our laws written in this language, right? And so not only can we not understand the language, you have to have a lawyer's degree to even understand it, and those people can't even understand it. You have all of these laws. I mean, let's see, 2012 it was, there were 60,000 laws passed in the United States alone. 60,000 laws. And of course, those laws are how many pages thick that they, you know, the Congress or whatever, the Senate doesn't even read it. And my thing is like, okay, well, we should be able to just dismiss this whole thing. Why? Because the human being can't remember that much. So we're bound by laws. And I mean, I can remember like 23
I love the saying, ignorance of the law is no excuse, when they pass 60,000 laws in a year and the Congress doesn't even freaking read them before passing them.
Yeah, I mean, can you recall or recite 60,000 of anything? Anything? Like, I mean, if you know, I mean, I can't. And so therefore, we are bound by these laws. And that is all it is somebody writing something down. And so we, so this is the power of our own language, you know.
Hmm. Well, that brings us close to the end of the second hour here as well with the really quite compelling Marty Leeds. And I just was speaking to my wife over the first hour break there, and she was doing a bit of analysis of our household finances. And we're about $900 in the red for this week alone, ladies and gentlemen. So I'm actually going to have to really step it up a bit and try and solicit some more donations out of the audience. And I apologize for putting you under this obligation, but we've got rent to pay. The power bill just came in. Water bill will be coming in next. Sarah's vehicle doesn't have a registration, so that means she could get pulled over at any point by a police officer and get a $700 fine or something of that nature. So that needs to be done as well, and this is not including food. So we need $900 within the next 3 to 4 days if we're just going to stay above water. And I hate to put this obligation on you, ladies and gentlemen, but it is not a choice. It is a lack of option. So please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com right now. As soon as you've heard this, this is your obligation, your moral obligation to support me and make sure that this show continues. And it is a very time-sensitive thing as well, so I'd appreciate it if you would also share this out with other people and let them know about this crisis that we're in as well. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number 3 of the most thrilling 3 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, and my very special guest is Marty Leeds. Now, Marty, you know about wormholes, right? Like an Einstein-Rosen bridge? I was just thinking over the break, I wonder if an Einstein-Rosen bridge is just as expensive as an Eckhart Tolle bridge. Okay.
I have nothing to say. Your damn puns, man. They stopped me cold in my tracks.
Oh, they're just freaking relentless. In fact, if anybody's listening to this show and on the blog archive and what have you, could you actually just leave comments in the the audio archive to just tell me on a scale of 1 to 10 just how bad my freaking puns are? You know, are they something that make you cringe and hate me or something of that? You'd be forgiven for both. Okay, well, anyway, we wanted to talk about legalese. Now, it's not an Asian language from the country Legal. It is, in fact, a language with which the laws are written, and it's a very, very interesting thing because it's not English. All right, it ain't English. For example. Here's a better example. Do you understand that it's not English? Now, if I'm telling you that in English, it means, do you comprehend? Is it something that you know? And then you go, yes, I do. But if I was speaking legalese to you, it understand means, do you stand under my authority? Mm-hmm. Now, you'll notice every time a cop busts you for something, he'll accuse you of a crime and then say, do you understand? If you say, no, I don't understand, he goes, damn it. Are you sure you don't understand? And you're like, yes, I'm sure I don't understand at all, Mr. Officer, sir. I don't have 3 bags full of wheat, you know, in the Baba black sheep sense of the word. And he won't be able to do anything if you don't understand his authority. Isn't that great? They ask you every single time before they bust you. And I see him on these cop shows and whatnot before my TV got cut off and I couldn't be bothered getting it reconnected it because TV is just basically, as Bill Hicks said, I'm taking a big fat black magic marker and covering up your third eye with it. But yeah, that's what they do. And all these people, I believe that you're driving drunk. Do you understand? Yes. Okay, now you're arrested. It's just like right away, instantly. And as soon as you understand legalese, you start to see the depth of the corruption itself. Yeah. The corruption will give you a conniption. I think that's about right.
And if you say that you don't understand, at least now, cops don't even care. They'll just tase you and drag you out of your car or whatever. You know, so it's like even that is, we've surpassed that now with this police state, which is just really, yeah, really sickening.
You kind of have two choices. You can either give up your own personal sovereignty and authority and give it to the police, who will arrest you, charge you, then you get convicted and or thrown in jail. Or you can retain your sovereignty, get tased, get beaten, then thrown in a police cell, get tortured, and then go to court, and then get let off. Those are your choices. Doesn't seem like a very nice choice, eh?
You know, and when people are trying to... You know, people are trying to make moves right now to, like, you know, expose all of this stuff, right? Expose the legalese, expose the, you know, the falsehoods and of, you know, the fallacies of the IDs and things like that, the fallacy of the IRS and things like that. And, you know, the thing is like, you can stand alone and try to fight these people, and more than likely you are going to lose. And this is why I think that it really comes down to the fact of coming together and making a stand en masse. You know, because if I don't pay my taxes this year, I'm going to have an IRS beat down my door. They're going to take my stuff. You know, they're going to, you know, charge me with, you know, financial servitude, yada, yada, yada. Right. But if we can come together at one point and say, look, we're redeclaring our independence, it's not that we don't believe in maybe a constitution or whatever. We don't believe in all of these things, whatever, you know, I don't want to go too far with this. But all I want to say is there's enough people out there that know that there's an absolute corruption that has infiltrated all of these different governments, and that we need to come together and make a stand and let the government know. That's what you know, that's what our founding fathers did in this country anyway. I don't want to get too much into this, but they came together and declared their independence from a tyrant, from a despot. You know what I mean? And we're in that position right now that, you know, of course, our founding fathers in the United States, there's, you know, untold wars. And I mean, our flag is stained with the blood of the past. You know, I'm not trying to paint these guys as saints or anything like that. But the one thing that they did do was they came together and they declared their independence, saying, no, no more. And they did it en masse. And we need to do that right now, because if you don't carry your ID and you get pulled over, you're screwed. You don't pay taxes, you're screwed. You say that, oh, I don't understand, you're screwed. You're going to get beat by the cops. And so we need to, and my opinion on this is to, you know, literally pick a date, use all of these different, you know, your show, all these different podcasts, all these people that are online, Facebook, and make a grand statement and say no more. And it's going to happen on, I don't know, July 4th or whatever, you know? Maybe that's unrealistic. Maybe that's a little idealistic, maybe. But at the same time, we've had a history of where they've done it before, so.
Oh, yeah. leaders, okay? Do you like to have a leader, Marty? I don't think so. You like to be your own leader, right? Same with me.
Marty leads.
Of course.
Sorry, I tried to add into the jokes.
Oh my god, Marty's actually like joining in. I've infected him with my incredibly lame pun manufacturing ability. Okay, now this is what happens when you have a really good leader. Leaders can bring people together, they can stop people being divided, and they can make things happen via the support of people behind them, using them as a lightning rod to draw countless more to their cause. Leaders can also manipulate, deceive, deprive people of their personal power and sovereignty. They can also divide other people, and they can also destroy everything that they say that they are there to build. Okay? Now, I think because the latter type of leader has become far more prominent in modern society, it's made people not believe that there is a good leader left of any kind. Right? Now, I consider myself a leader in the truth movement here in New Zealand. I know a number of other people do. However, leadership comes with a lot of responsibilities, right? And most people, maybe even including myself, don't want those responsibilities. We only want to be responsible for ourselves. And this is the irony. We need people who don't want power to be in power, to prevent those people who do from taking away our power in general.
Or
what a freaking paradox.
Yeah. Or everybody becomes the leader. You know what I mean? When I say, like, we get together in an en masse and declare your independence, you don't need a leader. You know, you certainly don't need me. You don't need you. All you need to do is have people say that we don't need those leaders anymore. We will lead ourselves. Mm-hmm. This is honestly, when you get into the original, breakdown of the Constitution.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no central government. There is no IRS. There is no central bank. There is no. In fact, I think one of the lines in the Constitution that says that the Congress shall meet at least once a year. It's like, they're saying that, hey, everybody, you're just going to stay at home, but you have to meet once a year. Not there 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. It's like, hey, man, go home. You're not, according to the Constitution, you're supposed to meet at least once a year. So, I mean, and I don't want to get too much into the Constitution because it's controversial. I know that. The idea of leading, I think everyone, it becomes the leader. This is the idea of having your creator-given sovereign rights.
Yeah.
You become the leader. You become the leader.
And now I came up with a 360 brainwashing philosophy. What if you
I'm not good with numbers.
Yeah. Well, it's actually 360 is just a full circle, all right? You come full circle. That's what it means. 360 brainwashing. So you use brainwashing techniques in order to brainwash people into realizing that they're being brainwashed so that they go full circle and they realize, oh my God, I'm totally brainwashed. And that way it'll actually allow them to wake up from it. Right? It's like using the weapons of the enemy against him. You get stabbed with a spear, pull it out of your own body and shove it through his eye socket. You know? That kind of thing. This an inability to accept failure, I think, is one of the strongest points in human beings. You'll see somebody who's downtrodden again and again and again, yet they do not get mired in their failure. They keep going forever, if necessary, until they achieve their success, because they know that what they're fighting for is worth all of that failure. Much like trying to invent a light bulb 100 times is a hell of a lot worth it, because, hey, you wind up inventing a frickin' light bulb, don't you? And you change the world. That's what people have got to realize, is it's not just about leading and brainwashing and power and exposing the scumbaggery and all of that kind of stuff. It's about just not admitting failure, or rather not being resigned to it. Like, for example, I have a certain degree of resignation to failure. And it's like this. Somebody asked me once, Vinny, what are you doing? What you're doing with all the overarching scumbaggery and everything? You know, you're probably going to lose. And I go, well, I accept that I'll probably lose. But the problem with that is I have a moral obligation for victory. So I don't give up. You know, regardless of whether or not I'm going to lose eventually, I will not. I will not force myself to lose. It has to be something that will either end my life or end my ability to speak. Somebody will cut out my voice box, and even if they do that, I'll still get one of those little things and just go, "Good evening, everybody. I'm Vinny Eastwood, and I'm going to teach you how to expose scumbaggery."
Yeah, failure is just a stepping stone to higher understanding. I think it was Henry Rollins that said, half of your life is failing and the other half is dealing with it, in respect. I mean, I don't know how many times I've sat down and tried to write a song and, you know, didn't get to it, or I wrote some hot steaming pile of crap. But then, out of 50 failures, there was the one that was really, really good, you know, that I was really proud of, that I was, you know, no ego whatsoever to look at it and say, hey, man, and that one song was worth the 50 failures before because just how great it was. And so that's one of the great lessons that human beings have to learn, that don't fear your failures, you know, embrace them, you know, because everybody fails, everybody screws up, you know.
Yeah, and being wrong is a form of failure that people avoid, and in fact, I actually love being wrong. I actually prefer to be wrong over being right, because when I'm right, I've actually learned nothing. When I'm wrong, I have learned something valuable, so I can stop being so wrong. Okay, that's why I value being proven wrong. That's why I value people who have evidence that contradicts the things that I think, because if what I'm thinking isn't true, and I hold on to that belief, so much as the worst for me. And I believe Mark Twain said, when an honest man is confronted with the truth that he is wrong, he will either cease to be wrong or cease to be honest.
Yeah, yeah, I love that quote. Yeah, I love that one. Yeah, for sure. Not only admitting that you're wrong, but admitting that you don't know. I think this is really important. In fact, I would say the first time I was on the show, I was talking and you didn't know a word that I said, and you stopped me and asked me. I think you're like one of the first people that in the last like year that's ever done that. Most people just act like they know or be like, well, I don't want to think that he thinks that I'm stupid or something like that. And it's like, no, man, if you don't ask, then how are you going to know? And if you just stop and ask the question, then it's all like, then all of a sudden that's not you not knowing anymore. That's just you recognizing that, hey, that's the next step to being a more understanding, more intelligent, brighter person. I don't know. I've been on a bunch of podcasts, and I guess maybe they understand what I'm saying. I'm not the most well-spoken person in the world, but that's I honor that. I mean, I think that's honorable that you stop and be like, wait a second, what does that even mean? I think that's – we need to do that. We need to embrace those qualities.
Mm. So. Well, I have two favorite and hated phrases, and they're three words each. Most hated phrase is I don't care. All right. Yeah. You know, as soon as somebody doesn't care, they've basically just said, I'm voiding all humanity within myself. I freaking hate that. My three favorite words are, I don't know, because it implies that you've actually got some form of humility left. It implies that you are actually intelligent enough to realize that you don't know everything.
Yeah, there's something very humbling about educating yourself, just being growing up and educating yourself in general. I think it was Voltaire, I want to say, that said something to the effect of, the more you know, the more you realize that you can't know, and the more you realize you don't know. So whenever I see somebody that acts like they're all high and mighty and that they're so intelligent above everybody, that just proves to me that that's just so much that you really, really don't know. Because I know that. I mean, I've read, thousands of books or hundreds of books, whatever. I've done a lot of introspection, contemplation, documentaries, all that stuff. And at the end of the day, there is so much that I am completely, I have no idea about. And I think that's very humbling. I think and the pursuit of education in one way is very humbling, because it's like, OK, there's no, in a human lifetime, you can't understand everything. You just can't, And so I think that's once again, another important lesson. So
Now, there's another element between the New World Order agenda is to become post-human, to be technologically advanced. Now, with the Internet, it actually is possible to know almost everything. I mean, imagine if you had a chip in your brain that had the entirety of the Internet accessible. That would be about as close as a human being could come to knowing everything at any one time, wouldn't it?
In a material dimension, I guess you could say. Yeah. I'm not really big on the transhumanism thing.
Me neither. I think as soon as you think that being human is not good enough, that's when you start to dehumanize others.
Yeah, and I mean, my thing is, it's like, okay, well, even if transhumanism, even if that's on the horizon, right? Even if that's the case, it's like, I don't trust the companies that are going to, I mean, would you trust Microsoft to put in a new frontal lobe for you? I mean,
I wouldn't even trust Microsoft to put in a new earlobe for me.
Yeah, no kidding, right? I mean, that's the thing that's the most scary. I mean, you want to talk about what's that? Skynet, right? From Terminator 2, right? I mean, you want to talk about Skynet? I mean, putting microchips and things like that.
There actually is a Skynet. DARPA made it up.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't make this stuff up. And here's another thing, ladies and gentlemen, if you're watching movies and what have you, and you start getting freaked out by the possible futures and what have you in sci-fi films, I've got news for you. You will get more truth out of those movie studios like 20th Century Fox than you will out of Fox News.
Yeah, a lot of art actually reflects, in one way, is prophetic. It, reflects the future. I mean, I think that's a pretty consistent theme as well. How many years ago did we see, once again, you were talking about 1984, right? He was an artist that came out, an author, right? And now we're living in that.
The book 1984 was written in 1948.
Right?
Yeah, so all he did was reverse the numbers. It wasn't talking about a date or anything like that. He was talking about the mentality. I realize the fact that I was born in 1984 on the 29th of December, so I actually only saw like 2 days, two, 3 days tops of the year 1984, but I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, I have lived my entire life in the concept of 1984.
Yeah. And how many people are absolutely bereft of this, have no idea about this, you know what I mean? How many people applaud the NSA? How many people applaud, you know, I got a friend who just got his, I love him dearly, he's my best friend, just greatest guy in the world, but he just got a Swiss citizenship card, and he was all excited about it. I'm like, all you did is become a government employee. That's all you did. And he has no idea about that, you know? Mm. And he was really excited because he's 100% Swiss and stuff. And he's a great guy, intelligent guy too. But he's a lot of times, even my own peers are not exposed to this stuff. And that's why I'm trying to do everything I can, you know? And it's.
Yeah. Well, you know what the real crux of the issue is? All complicated issues have often simple realizations or simple problem-solving things that you can come to. I think it's the fact that we're trying to control other people. We're trying to control what other people think, what other people do, and what have you. And at the end of the day, it's because we've forgotten the fact that we're not even in control of our own lives. And in order to subvert and make ourselves forget that really terrible realization, we try and put it onto everybody else. And that's government in a nutshell. That's the legislation in a nutshell. That's the judiciary in a nutshell, is that everybody's wrong, doesn't know what they're talking about, and out of an effort to prevent themselves from being found out in that way, they make sure that everybody else becomes just as stupid, just as controlled, and just as dependent as they are, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, we've just abdicated our personal responsibility, and again, those two words, I love those two words. Mark Passio gave me these, moral obligation. Love that, Shiite Muslim.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, look. What kind of a life are you living if there ain't no morality involved in it? You know? I mean, somebody without morals being in control of, I don't know, your city, your life, or your county, or whatever, what happens to all of those things? They get destroyed, don't they? Morality is kind of like the glue that holds our social fabric together. And I believe the New World Order is has one of its agendas is to destroy morality in and of itself. It's a self-replicating organism, morality is. You know, you raise a child with moral means, that child will grow up to be a moral parent. It's like that. And the same thing is with a lack of morality. If you beat your children or put them in pedophile cults or something of that nature, that child will replicate those things on their own children as well. And I think we're approaching a point in history now that may or may not be unlike any other. I haven't seen any other point in history like this, where technology, as Ian Wishart, who wrote the book Totalitaria, has said, has come to the point that any dictator who does want to control the world in real time, the technology now exists to do that. This is the first time in living memory that this has been possible.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, but the technology exists at the same time to do the direct opposite, to give independence to the entire world at the same time. And it's like it's a race, okay? Human beings are the hare, and the New World Order is the tortoise. The tortoise has been very, very steadily going along that racetrack, and at the very, very end, they win, and not only do they win now, but they win forever. They will set up a system which is completely irresistible. Nobody will ever be free, ever again, in the entirety of history. Impossible. They will be too well suppressed. We're the hare who took a rest under the tree, and while our eyes were closed, an entire society was built up around us, and we are now aware that the tortoise is near the finish line, and we're simply running, hoping that we get across it first.
Yeah, and education is the true power behind all of this. When you educate people, you know, because that's when people are educated, and they're woken up. Yeah, that you can't control these people, you know, The idea of waking up and the idea of the spiritual context of this, you know, this is recognizing once again your own sovereignty, you know, that you control your vessel. This is your body. No one is your authority. The only authority is, I mean, you basically have three authorities, if you will, your parents, the great creator, and yourself. Why are your parents your authority? Because they authored you. Why is the great creator your authority? Because it authored you. Why are you your authority? Because you author your life. you know? And so when you wake up to this knowledge, there's somebody that claims authority over you in any sort of way is just a complete and utter falsehood. It's just false. Because by, once again, going right to the very definitions of the word. And this is, honestly, this is what true spirituality is. This is what, honestly, what the true religions are talking about. Because when you look at Buddha, Buddha just means the one who woke. That's all it means. What do you think he woke up to? He woke up to realizations such as this. We live in a different time frame, of course. We live in a different time period. But the same things were happening in 500 BC that were happening in 500 AD that are happening in, you know, right now. And so we're in the same position that everybody in history has always been. It's always been this fight between good and evil, and you got to decide, you know, what side are you going to be on?
And here's the problem, though, but and again, the difference between this point in history and any other is they now have the tools to finish the job, right? It's kind of like it's the first time that it's possible to have a once and for all evil wins or good wins.
Yeah, I mean, Mother Nature is going to reclaim everything. You know what I mean? You know, that's how Mother Nature works. Nothing ever lasts. You know what I mean? So when we were talking about transhumanism, we talk about the internet and things like that. And people, you know, they look 100 years in the future and be like, oh, we're going to merge with machines and things like that. Yeah, maybe that might happen. I don't know. I'm not prophetic in any way. But I will say this, that eventually this thing will fall. This thing will fall because that's just how Mother Nature works. Nothing ever lasts. I mean, can you name one civilization from 2500 BC that's the exact same civilization as it is now? No, all of those civilizations fell. The Greeks, you know, the Romans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this is going to fall too. So what we have to do as in this moment of time is make our mark where we can. So, it, you know, if it ever does fall or, you know, like you said, if the power control and the power structure increases as it is, that people will be educated and then we can make that fight, you know what I'm saying?
Well, and I think this is actually the very reason why the New World Order seized control of religious and educational institutions is to indoctrinate people into believing the exact opposite of what's real. And in so doing, that's what fallacy means. It comes from fallare, to mean to lie. It means that almost everything that they're trying to teach you, appeal to authority is one of the known logical fallacies. And guess what everybody appeals to in a crisis? The authorities will save us. Right. So the people who lie to you and destroy your life invariably throughout the entirety of history are the people that are going to save you now. Is that what you think is going to happen? You know?
Yeah, and this thing with authority too, and the idea of recognizing one's own spirituality, I think is a really important point in looking at all the laws. I think we were going to talk about this earlier in the break. I kind of want to hit in on this, but we're kind of getting into it right now, is the idea of covering, because since you just got married and being authority, who's your authority? The great creator, the great spirit, the great mystery, yourself and your parents until you become, you know, an adult or whatever.
I thought my authority was my great missus.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, exactly. I guess you have four authorities, right? It's like what was that thing I heard? I have three bosses: my old lady, the God above, and Bruce Springsteen.
Because anyway, he's literally the boss.
He's the boss. Yeah. Dun, 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 dun. Talking about authority, right? The idea is when we're talking about getting married, right? Like you just got married and you didn't sign any documents and you're not getting married to the government. When you think about this spiritually, right? Okay, two people get together and they're in love with each other. And then they have to go get a marriage license, which is a license, which is a permit, right? When you think about this in a spiritual context, right? The idea is that, how do I want to go into this? In Hinduism, right, you have this term that says it's namaste, right? It's this greeting that they say in India. And, of course, this has been developed in the West as well. Namaste means nam, which is name, and aste means star, right? So it's basically saying, what's your name? You're a star. Now, we know we're born from stardust, right? Carl Sagan said, what is he? The DNA, the nitrogen in our DNA, the calcium in our teeth, the carbon in our apple pies. We're made in the center of collapsing stars. We are made of star stuff, right? Well, spiritually, this idea of namaste is recognizing that what you do is you say namaste to a person, and then you bow your head. And that other person bows their head and says, namaste. And what you're doing is recognizing that you have inside your heart is the small ounce of fire of the scintilla of the creator within your heart. And that's where it exists. It's in your heart. And this is the creator gave you this, right? Once again, your authority gave you this. Now, when two people come together, whether they're gay or straight or whatever, what are they doing? They're coming together and saying in front of their friends, their family, in front of God or the great Wiccan witch of the West or Mother Gaia or whatever it is, they're saying in front of, making this proclamation in front of the entire universe that they're saying, see this person here? I'm committed to that person. Death to us part, I'm going to be there to the very end. And that other person saying, I'm committed to that person too. And so what are you doing when you come together in this act of love, in this act of marriage, in this act of communion? You're saying, this piece, this scintilla of this spark in my heart, I'm giving this to this other person. That person is giving it to me, right? And you're doing this, and because God, if you will, gave this to you. Now, before you do that, you got to go get a permit from the government. So you're about to proclaim in front of all your friends and all your family, the entire universe and God himself, that you want to give your soul to another human being. And what does the government say? Well, not first. First you got to get a permit or a license for me. This is the thing that I really want to address to, lesbian and gay people. Don't ask for permission to get married. Don't ask for permission to get married. Don't go pleading to the government for the right to get married. You have the right. You have the right that was given to you by your creator. If you want to go get married, get married. Hey, I'm a minister at the Universalist Life Church. I got it online. I can marry anybody I want. I'll marry you right now. I don't care what state it's in. I don't care, man, because that is absolutely ridiculous. You know what I mean? This is something that, whether we talk about corruption, politics, anything like that, why in the world is the government have anything to do with love? You know, this is an absolute travesty. It's absolutely absurd. And this is something that is very close to my heart and why I'm not married.
Mm.
So,
well, technically, I'm not legally married.
Yeah.
We had a common law marriage and no paperwork. We said before God, yes, and all of our guests and everybody around us, we're married now. Sarah Eastwood, Finney Eastwood, Mr. and Mrs. There's no legal documentation because I don't believe in that stuff. What I do believe is in the power of my promise and the power of the promise of my wife to honor and keep each other, right? That is the only thing that matters. Anybody else says that a piece of paper is more valuable than a man and a wife's honor to commit to each other is full of crap.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to me, this is something that should just be addressed. And once again, when I hear of these arguments with like gays and lesbians, I mean, I guess Uruguay, they just signed something that said that if you get married or that you're a lesbian or gay, that I don't know what it is, like you get fined or something or jail time or I forget what it is. It's just something crazy, you know. And it's just like,
isn't that interesting that a country that whose name sounds remarkably like you are gay would do something like that? You can't make this stuff up, folks.
Yeah, yeah. I know. It's like the it's like that guy Anthony Weiner that got caught showing his wiener.
I know.
Like the government. I mean, like the cosmos is playing these like crazy, funny games with us or something like that. You know, it's just nuts.
Yeah, yeah. Does anybody think that the universe is just messing with me, man?
Yeah.
And the answer is yes.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when you're playful with this stuff too, because I honestly think that there's, I mean, I know this is going to draw some laughter, but I think there's some legitimacy in romanticizing and poeticizing and looking at things like that romantically. I mean, you know what I mean? Looking at things like in a poetic sense, yeah, like Uruguay, and they just passed a law that says you can't be gay. You know, Anthony Weiner showing his wiener. You know what I mean? It's like we live in this kind of like Coen Brothers film or something. But
yeah,
when you look at a guy like, let's talk about Mark Passio, for instance. I was just thinking about this today. Mark Passio, in his name, he's filling out his own archetype. Look at what he's doing. What is he doing? What do you do when you mark something? You make your mark, right? You make your mark on this world. And how is he doing it? With passion? All you did is throw an N at the end. Now, that's silly. That's ridiculous, some people think. I don't think so. I don't, especially when you talk about when we started this whole conversation with saying God, the tetragrammaton, is in our language.
Mm.
Is it so absurd to think that this being, that all of these people, I'm just going to tell you my honest opinion, that this is my experience with this, that's exactly what it is. That it's this creative natural force that is interpenetrating and working with our language.
Yeah.
You know, that's just, well, so.
Incidentally, adding on to that, when I was interviewing Mark Passio, my wife brought home some toilet paper whose brand name was Paseo, P-A-S-E-O. It wasn't spelled the same, but yeah. And we were talking about bullshit. and again, you can't make it up.
I know. And honestly, like I said, I know this kind of is going to draw some laughter. It's be like, oh, this is kind of ridiculous and stuff. But when you get into this sort of magical, mystical mindset, you know, you'll start seeing things like that all the time. And you can just, you know, blow them off and say, oh, it's just your imagination. Yeah, maybe it is. What you're saying, that's not valid. I would say that all the alchemists and hermeticists and great philosophers of the past said that's absolutely valid, you know. So that's, you know, just, you know, something to think about for people that have never thought about that before anyway.
Yeah. And incidentally, when we're talking about this right now, it's exactly 33 minutes into the third hour.
I know. I just did this podcast. It was a SyncBook Radio podcast. And I was
Alan Ebedissa.
Actually, I'm doing his show Thursday with Scott Onstott, by the way.
Scott's awesome. Yeah,
Scott's a great guy. Yeah. So anyway, I did this podcast, and I was on the podcast to talk about 11/11, right? And I was on the podcast that was the number 121. It was the 121st podcast, and I didn't know that. And we just talked about it on the air because none of us recognized it. Well, 11/11, I was talking about 11/11. 11/11, 11 times 11 is 121. And I just happen to be on the 121st podcast talking about 11/11. It's things like that that show up all the time. You're talking about 33, right? You moved into the apartment 33. You have your desk at 33. I just did Red Ice Creations yesterday, and I had written this down because I wanted to talk about it, but we didn't get a chance to do it. Red Ice Creations, I was Red Ice in the cipher. Is R-E-D-I-C-E is 554, red. And then ice is 535. Well, this is the numbers 14 and 13. So reading this backwards is 3141, right? So it's pi. So, and they, of course, they didn't know about any of this stuff. This is just pi. We find the same phenomenon in the alphabet. There's a bunch of different words like this that have 3141. Now, of course, Red Ice Creations, Henrik met a girl named Lana and got married to her. And she was born on 314. And of course, she started a podcast that's called Radio 314. And then they moved to South Carolina, I think it is. And they moved into a place that was, the address was 314. And I said, you know, I was thinking about this. I wanted to talk to them about it. But so I'm glad we're kind of bringing this up right now. But to me, it's like, okay, that's all just coincidence. Maybe. Or maybe there's an underlying order that we just don't understand because we are not using our imaginations.
Well, and that's why actually it's good that you brought up the Sync Book and Alan Ebedezer Green, because he helped me to realize that there is a hell of a lot more than coincidence at work here, that synchronicity is merely looking at meaningful coincidence. It is a coincidence, sure, but it doesn't mean that coincidence is without meaning. And I think that's the essence of synchronicity, is that actually you can derive meanings from coincidences that are very accurate sometimes.
Yeah, and I think one of the easiest ways to, just like you said with like the number 7 and number 33, and this is the exact experience that I've had dealing with this information, I think that the easiest way to see coincidences in your life is to get into numbers, because numbers are all over us. I mean, we're surrounded by them all the time, and most people shun numbers. They cringe at numbers. They cringe at mathematics. Thank you to our wonderful school system for that. And when you actually get into this, you realize you don't start seeing numbers as just numbers or equations or anything. You start seeing them as a language. Just like when you read a book, you don't read the letters. You don't read the words. You're reading the story. When you get into the language of mathematics, you start reading, if you will, the story of our universe.
What this reminds me of is one night I was at my computer and I was going to process a video, then go to bed. Okay, so it tells you how many minutes the video's got left to process. And it says exactly 33 minutes left to process. And I go, okay. And then I'm walking back towards the bedroom and I go past the washing machine that's going, that has how many minutes left to go until it's finished its cycle? 33 minutes. And then I get in bed and look at my alarm clock radio and it's 3:33 in the morning.
That's funny.
You know? I was just laughing to myself. That's classic, man.
Yeah. And so how many kind of like reductionist, mechanistic scientists would look at that and just be like, oh, that's just ridiculous. It's just coincidence. There's no meaning there. There's no meaning to life and things like that. And at one point in my life, I would have said the exact same thing. But now, dealing with numbers for so long, it's like that idea, because of, I mean, I've had things like that, like you were just talking about, that stuff goes on hourly. I mean, I'm not even joking, man. That stuff happens all the time where it's just like I'll be thinking of something, like I'll be literally doing mathematics, and I was like, hey, I came up with the number 123, and I'll look at the clock, and it'll be 123. You know, things like that where you're just like, okay, any other number could have came up in what I'm working with, but it didn't. Hmm. And it came up at that exact point, and that happens all the time.
Somebody trying to explain that to me is if you buy a particular type of car that you don't see very often, but as soon as you buy that car and as soon as you're driving around in it, you notice that it's everywhere. There's heaps of different cars like that, absolutely everywhere. And I think that actually does work as well, but it doesn't explain absolutely everything. It's almost like we have, as human beings, endowed with certain abilities to, in fact, change the very fabric of reality to suit what it is we want or what it is we expect. And I don't know exactly what the mechanism is, but we are actually capable of changing what is to fit our ideas. It's just occasionally people get it mixed up and they think that you can change everything that is with your own ideas and that nothing matters, and that means everything is just a result of your perception, which is just solipsism, as Mark Passio explains, which is BS. If anything... how did I explain this? Oh, yeah. You know the double helix DNA? Okay. Oh, yeah. Imagine one strand down the side, down one rotating part of the spiral is reality, and the other strand rotating around the spiral is perception. Together, they're capable, with reality and perception working together, to create totally different DNA, totally different people, and absolutely everything that exists. You know, it doesn't mean one dominates the other. It's that one cannot exist without the other.
Yes, and I think this is really an elevation of consciousness when you really talk about it. When you talk about seeing, you know, seeing a car and then all of a sudden you see cars all the time. Seeing numbers and all of a sudden you see, you know, numbers all the time. I think this is an actual expansion of our consciousness. It's how we can actually interpret and change our reality through our own mechanism of mind. Speaking of Scott Onstad, he brought up this really great point. I remember I forget what he was talking about, but he was talking about that when he would go hunting for mushrooms in the forest, he'd look and he'd look and he'd look and he wouldn't find any, and then he'd find one, and then all of a sudden he saw them everywhere. You know what I mean? It's the same kind of thing, and it's the same thing with numbers. It's the same thing. It's the same thing with corporate logos and things like that. When you start to understand what you know, how the same themes, same elements. As soon as you start seeing one, you're going to start seeing them all over, and then you're going to see, oh, there's some connectivity there, I believe, right?
Yeah. I think a lot of things, or at least the most important things in life, are usually cruel ironies of some description. I recall a friend of mine, he was studying the effects of cannabis on the brain, heavy cannabis use, and what he found in his subjects was that their IQ was increasing, but it was at the cost of their short-term memory. So they're having all these really brilliant ideas, but would forget that they'd have them.
So the moral of the story is, stoners, write stuff down, man.
Yeah. We have recording devices are going, I mean, why do you think I record all my shows, man? You know?
That's funny.
Now, the other element here as well is having fun. Okay, if you're not having fun in your life, you know what the hell's the point? I'm sure many people have come to that philosophical conclusion of their own. However, a lot of times you'll find that life just ain't fun, man. And you actually have to use your imagination and you have to make stuff up in order to make those things fun. I mean, the show, for example, tagline, the lighter side of genocide. Genocide's not freaking funny, is it? At all. And you know what's what it is about things that aren't funny ever at all is that they don't allow humor to be brought into them. So in order to be able to deal with these things, you have to force and create humor where none exists in order to balance the equation. And we've been given that ability. And I think it's a wasteful squandering to take everything too seriously, especially ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, we're, number one, I think we're one of the only species that actually laughs. I mean, I think that we are the only species that really can just, you know, belly up and chuckle and laugh. And so I think that that's an integral part, a necessary part of being a human being. This is actually true spirituality. This is what it means. This is spirituality. This has nothing to do with going to church or believing in any sort of BS or adopting any belief system or not being a critical thinker or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Spirituality means to be spirited. That's what it means. To live, to laugh, to love, to have appreciation to your fellow man, to, you know, to have integrity, to be honest, to laugh, to, you know what I mean? Those sorts of things. And enjoy this life. And even when it gets you down, you know, even when you have those failures, it's to stand up and do it again and get to that next point. You know, how many people would, like I said, when talking about writing songs, how many people would pick up a guitar and spend 2 weeks at it and be like, oh, I can't do that, you know, and yet having no idea the amount of joy that learning an instrument can bring you, if you know what I'm saying. You know, this is the key factor, one of the key factors that I try to point out when I'm talking about spirituality. All it is finding your individuality and letting it bloom in full force, you know, letting it, you know, all the laughter out, letting be the warrior of the mind, the heart, the spirit, and everything like that. You know, that's true spirituality.
Yeah, I mean, it's like jamming and flowing. You actually, if you come up with a good song off the top of your head with a bandmate or something of that nature, it's like a spiritual experience. Right,
it is a spiritual experience.
You feel something. You feel something, and it's not like a physical sensation. It's not a mental sensation. It's something more, something deeper.
This is, I think, I try to, as like a singer songwriter, an artist, or whatever. Even when I like write books or when I'm doing any sort of research, this is the space that I try to get into. And it's basically the space where you become a conduit for the creative force within creation, if you will. You become a conduit for it. You're not, and this is well known in like, you know, jam bands or jazz. If jazz musicians call it real gone. It's where you get to this place where I don't know what song I'm playing. I don't know what key I'm playing in. I don't know even know who I'm playing with. I don't know, you know, et cetera. I don't know what I'm going to play next. But I'm just letting this stuff just flow out of me. And most musicians that I know try to get to this place. I mean, I think like true professional musicians. And I don't know how many people I've heard talk about this, that they're really just kind of interpreting things that they receive from the other or whatever. You know, I've heard... I mean, just tons of musicians. I mean, it could just Tom Waits has talked about this, and you know, I mean, Adam Duritz has talked about this. I mean, it could just go on and on about musicians, and I've heard comedians talk about this, that when they get on stage, they get into this place where they don't, you know, they don't even know what the next thing is coming out of their mouth. They have they have their bits and everything like that, but everything's just kind of flowing out. This is the place that I think we want to get to in our whole life. This is the Tao. That's what it's saying, the ever-flowing way. You get into that ever-flowing way, and you just flow with creation, and that's when you can really let that that force come out of you, if you will.
Which is why they named the stock market after it, I'm sure.
Yeah, I know. Once again, talking about being creative and being imaginative, being artistic with you know, words and things like that. Do you think that's a coincidence? You think the perversion of such a holy idea of the Tao, and then you find that in our stock market, you think that's a coincidence? I don't think that's a coincidence at all, man. You know?
Well, there's intention behind everything, even if the intention wasn't behind the person doing the thing. And I'll evidence this by talking about the invention of the telescope. Do you know who invented the telescope?
Who's that?
There were 9 guys who invented the telescope. At the exact same night at 9 different places around the earth.
I've heard that. Yeah. Wow. I haven't thought about that in a long time. I've heard that. Yeah, that's interesting, huh?
Yeah. And they were all accusing each other of plagiarizing off each other when none of them knew each other or did anything, and they all had that same idea. It was like an aerial from God or something like that just came in. Hey, bro, you know that that really hot naked Spanish chick in that villa across the way there?
I got a shot of her, man.
I can tell you how to figure out a device where you could get a closer look without even getting closer. They're like, oh, bro.
The first telescopes were invented for porn.
Exactly. I mean, necessity is the mother of all creativity, is it?
It was only like 100 years later, and it was like, hey, we could use this to look at the stars.
Wait, you could see stars with this too? Oh, that's funny, well, eh?
talking about this creative force within creation and letting it flow out, I think that when you're on the path of self-discovery, when you're a true seeker and you're going to truly find wisdom and truly find the truth, I think this stuff starts coming into a confluence into your life, if you will. This stuff started happening all around you. We were just talking about Red Ice Creations, right? They didn't know any of that stuff. They didn't know about the cipher for the English alphabet, or they've never, neither one of those people have, Lana or Henrik or Frederick or any of those guys, I don't think, studied pi or anything like that. Yet everything that surrounded them was the 3141. You know what I mean? And I think, especially when you talk about, mathematics and geometry being the language of a creator, and that doesn't come from my mouth. That comes from the mouth of Plato, Pythagoras, of St. Augustine, Galileo, Kepler. You know, these guys are saying that this creative force is speaking, most often speaking through numbers and geometry. And this stuff just starts, I think, when you get on that path of finding your individuality, this stuff starts blooming in your life, and you can start to notice it, really notice it.
It's kind of like just not ignoring what's there. It's like an increased awareness sort of thing.
Elevation of consciousness.
Now again, this is actually what the institutions, the forced institutions, okay, the ones that you have to obey, okay, police, education, medicine, law, that those kind of things. That's actually, in my opinion, one of the design motifs of these institutions is to constrict and prevent the elevation of consciousness. Would you agree?
Yeah, this goes back to what we're talking about with the advertisers too, about feeding those lower animal natures. You know, the elevation of consciousness comes from the heart up. It's about taking all of these lower animal natures and bringing them up and bringing into your head and illuminating those dormant brain cells and having the elevation of consciousness. And all of those institutions, all of them are all focused on, when you go to the doctor, they're not going to look at your spiritual body or anything like that. They're not concerned with your heart or anything like that. You know, they're not concerned with your consciousness and how you feel and things like that. More often than not, in a lot of these, the big business institutions of medicine, of course, right? They're focused on the bug that's in you. You know, we're going to take care of the physical thing, and that's it. You know, and this is exactly what's going on. And you're absolutely right. I mean, this is what all of these institutions are doing. They're focusing on those lower animal, carnal, atavistic natures, and trying to keep us down in there. You know, and we don't want to be down. We want to go up. That's why the compass always points up.
Is that the nature of an institution in and of itself? Or could we create institutions that actually encourage creativity, that actually institute the lessons of how to achieve higher consciousness? Would that be possible, or is that an oxymoron in and of itself?
No, you're an institution, man. My website's an institution in one respect, you know? I mean, it's a place to go to learn new things or get a new perception of reality and that sort of thing. So, I mean, when you look at the mystery schools of old, right, the Platonic schools, the Pythagorean schools, things like this, those were institutions that were trying to, mystical schools that were trying to tell you about the divine within, the God that dwells within, and how to understand that, how to respect it, how to elevate your consciousness. I mean, this is what those schools were. So I think not only can there be institutions surrounding these ideas, but I think that it's honestly a good idea. What you got to know, you got to be aware every single day that it could be infiltrated. And I mean, I think this is what Freemasonry was. And unfortunately, we've already talked about that, what's happened with that. So I don't think institutions in and of itself are bad. Nothing in and of itself. I can't say nothing in and of itself is bad. Don't let me go there. But you know what I'm saying. You know, I think that we can build school systems that actually teach people to understand geometry, understand psychology, understand philosophy, understand the nature of creativity and the nature of the divine.
How about understanding the nature of authority and that it in and of itself, it's a fallacy? That would be interesting to have an institution like that, because only psychos and what have you who crave power and control and authority would attempt to infiltrate an institution that has power and authority. What if one was actually engaged in the point of actually doing the direct opposite?
Yeah. I mean, when
It'd
you
be like
teach
kryptonite, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you teach philosophy, when you study philosophy, one of the things you have to study about in philosophy is evil, period. You know, it's not just about rainbows and unicorns and all of that sort of stuff, man. It's understanding that there is a dark underbelly of this current. I mean, the greatest, Well, here.
The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing humanity it didn't exist. Was that what you were about to say?
Yeah, pretty much. Basically, philosophy, I guess it does. Well, here. I'm just going to show this. I'm sorry for the listeners that are only listening to this. This is a Freemason symbol. It's got the all-seeing eye of God in there. Those two pillars are basically talking about chaos and order, the sun and moon, man and woman,
it's Gog
good and evil.
Gog and Magog. No. Boaz and Jachin, I think they're called.
Yeah, Boaz and Jachin, yep. Yeah. Basically, when you understand that there's a unity of opposites in creation, that in order for creation to have been created, in order for us to have this gradation of experience, you need the polarities. And so when you start to understand your own psychology, your left and right brain, your positive and negative electromagnetic vehicle that you are, when you start to understand this, you have to understand both. And this is exactly what Mark Passio was talking about with the right and left brain. People are either left or they're right. You know, it's all good. It's all, you know, it's all new age bliss bunny stuff, or it's all scientism. It's all, you know, that sort of thing. When you get into philosophy, yeah, exactly. When you get into philosophy, you have to put both on the table, good and evil, and you have to deal with both of them and figure out how to navigate, if you will, how to balance and center those.
Well, and that comes back to my point that I made in the first hour, is that shutting off half of the hemisphere of your brain or knowledge of good or evil is like a champion runner saying, I've got to run this whole distance, but only using one leg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
To amputate that Shiite Muslim. Okay, well, thank you very much, Marty. And do you have anything final to say before we close up the show for today? Have you got a website or things of that nature?
Yeah, MartyLeeds33.com, MartyLeeds33 on YouTube. I'm a singer-songwriter, too, so you can go on my site, and I've got a record for sale as well. And then I just released two books, Pi in the English Alphabet, Volume 1, which is the second edition, and then The Peacock's Tales, The Alchemical Writings of Claudia Pavonis. And then the second edition of Volume 2 should be out very soon. I'm thinking like a week or two. So look forward to that. And then I actually just posted a new video today on the Hebrew alphabet and correlating the Hebrew alphabet to the English alphabet using 22 digits of pi. So I post new videos. I try to post new videos. I've been busy with the books, but I try to post videos once every 2 weeks or something like that. So, and I have about maybe like 12 or some more or something like that that I've got sketched out that'll be coming up. So all of that stuff, all those videos are free. You can look at all these deconstructions for absolutely free on my website or on YouTube. So check it out. So.
All right. Thank you very much, Marty. And thank you very much. You're welcome. And thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. Bear in mind, just to reiterate, we've just done the numbers, and we need about $900 in order to keep the boat afloat this week alone. So we only have three or four days left before we need to meet those costs. So if you would be generous enough to go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and donate, preferably through the KiwiBank account that is there, because they don't take a percentage like PayPal does, but if you don't have a choice, you don't have a choice. It's all right. Please, ladies and gentlemen, don't let me down. I haven't let you down, have I? Wait, I probably have, you know. In fact, I let everybody down all the time, but I've come to accept my failings and just, you know, try and work on them, you know. It's a process. All right, thank you very much, Marty, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll see you again sometime.